The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
All right, a very good morning to you. Welcome along to Wednesday morning's OTB AM. It's the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. And we're here every morning from 7:30 until 9:30 across a multitude of platforms. You can get us on Facebook, on YouTube. You can get us on Twitter through Periscope, or of course the best place to get us of all is offtheball.com. And you can listen to us as a radio show on the Go Loud app, which I presume you've all downloaded by now because we've been banging on about it long enough.
It's a good app.
Oh, you better have it. If I go to your phone and check and there's no Go Loud app, I'm throwing it out the window.
It's, I do need to get on that. Because I'm on the other side here, that automatically reduces one possible great show that I can listen to, so.
Yeah. It's an amazing piece of kit.
It actually is an amazing piece of kit. It's almost too good for my phone.
So it's considered a moral victory for Southampton last night when they only lose 3-1. Is that like a massive progress? 9-0, 3-1, nil all, 1-0, 2-0, and then 6 weeks time they'll be winning 9-0.
It's actually, if you go by goals conceded and the progress that they've made over the course of whatever 5-6 days, then they're going to win 5-0 the next day. So lose by 9, lose by 2. Oh, sorry. Then it is a seven goal jump. So they will win by 5.
That's not great.
No, it is. They will win by 5 next time. So that's the mathematical jump. It's I don't know. Like you lose to Manchester City, a team that starts with Sergio Aguero in the Carabao Cup. It's far more respectable than what happened last week. It couldn't get much worse for them. In terms of saving face, there's a long way to go. The scars that come from a 9-0 hammering probably run a little bit deeper than anything that could be kind of saved by a 3-1. Like, if Manchester City were on the other side of that last Friday night, do they beat Southampton 9-0, for example? This is a full gung-ho Manchester City in the Premier League, and this is still kind of a lowly Southampton. Like, I still maintain, as I was saying yesterday, that Leicester were just in the perfect position to rub their faces in the mud. And
well, they wanted it.
They really
don't need to do it.
Exactly. So I think that there was a very, very unhappy marriage of things that came together for Southampton last Friday night. And you just have to hope that things kind of get a little bit better for them, because it's a rather grim situation to be in a place where 9-0 is the start of tumbling down the hill.
Or maybe that's what happens to you when, you know, you mismanage your club over a period of time and all of a sudden you find yourself at the bottom of the Premier League and you're going down.
Well,
it could be a generation before they come back.
What sort of mismanagement are we talking here? Is it selling all your players to Liverpool?
I mean, not reinvesting that money properly.
Mm. That's always an issue. Like, reinvesting money properly is always a thing you can say in hindsight, because every prospect looks like a great prospect when they're signed for a club, especially when you're signing talents from some of the top leagues around Europe, and then when they arrive and they end up flattering to deceive, then you blame the structures of the club.
I was reading the match preview for Wolves against Villa tonight. Wolves have a pair of Serie A strikers that they bought for 16 million quid each who are going to start tonight, who have one goal between them in a combined 35 appearances so far this season.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of money sloshing around that is not being well spent in the Premier League.
No, it's being spent very, very badly, in fact. The problem is, if one of those hits, when you're an Aston Villa, when you're a Wolves, or whether you're a Southampton, then ultimately it's a sell to Manchester City job, it's a sell to Liverpool job.
It's survival for that season.
Yeah, and that's what it is. It's not like you sign a player and it's a hit and then all of a sudden you are sorted for the next few seasons. You sign a player, he's a hit. You move him on, you have to sign another player who's a hit. So recruitment, as we well know, is the most, it is the paramount thing when it comes to these football clubs at the moment.
Yeah. All right, anything else from last night?
Not really from last night, to be honest with you. That was like kind of the standout result, that Southampton didn't get absolutely and utterly smashed once again. So a happy moment for them. A couple of other things that we'll get to across the papers today. And Joey Carberry's injury is something that's come up doubtful for Europe. And there's been some kind of mixed reports as to whether or not it's an ankle injury or a knee injury across various media. Online and in the newspapers today, which is interesting because I actually hadn't heard about the possibility of a knee injury until today, but that's been reported in different places this morning. You've got like the Sky Doctor on testosterone, which we'll get to in a moment, Gordon Darcy's column, and I think, yeah, that's pretty much what we're looking at today.
Yeah, all right. We have a pretty interesting interview coming up a little bit later on, one of the big books of the Christmas period.
Yes, we're going to do it later on this afternoon. It's not coming your way until tomorrow morning. We've got Owen Larkin in, his book Camouflage is out, and it's pretty good. It's I tore through it over the last 48 hours or so. We've got him in studio later on, and there's some unreal moments when it comes to the insight that you get to Kilkenny hurlers from these books. The whole notion that, you know, Kilkenny don't do tactics, Kilkenny have a bit more thought when it comes to the science of hurling. We all thought that was going to be kind of blown out of the water when these guys retired, and they were going to write books and they were going to tell us about the tactical nuance that came with the Brian Cody era.
Bits of Jackie Tyrrell's book did do that. Zonal versus man-to-man in Tipperary from Drawn Game to Replay, for example. Go on.
But I just think that really, that's as scientific as it will get. Larkin kind of is...
There's one bit in particular in the book that you tweeted last night.
Yeah, I'm not sure we get that up. There's Jerry McEntee, of course, the Meath legend, used to come in and chat to the team before every All-Ireland final. I think he actually probably did it this year, according to Larkin. And the analogy he used at the end was, put your foot on his head and don't take it off until you see the last bubble. So drowning a man is how he used to compare winning All-Irelands to. And that's something that even stuck out to Larkin, who I think it's fair to say was... Is old school the right word? I'm not sure if it is. Certainly, he was a bit more fundamental in his thinking than a lot of emerging hurlers might have been over the last 5 or 6 years. He would talk about the Tipperary team. He would talk about how they would score a goal or they would score a point, and they'd point to their head. That was their trigger to get back in position. They had those sort of mental triggers anyway, the Tipperary team. And he says basically that was just a load of nonsense, and they loved kind of beating them because of that nonsense, because they could put them back into their place and they would show them actually all you need.
They had the best team of all time.
Well, you see, that's the thing. That's probably what informs this view.
Yeah.
And it also kind of suggests to me that, is that mentality a product of what Brian Cody did with Kilkenny, a product of Brian Cody's philosophy, or are all those players actually just Brian Cody players because they naturally had that mentality anyway? It's probably a
topic. He weaned out anybody who didn't have it.
Potentially, I don't know. It's something that we might ask Larkin later on. It's always.
Could we get Jerry McEntee and talk to the Irish rugby team before the next big game?
It mightn't be the worst idea. It does seem that the drowning analogy is something that perhaps the All Blacks would have had against us a couple of weeks ago. Perhaps England would have had against them.
And South Africa will have it, and we'll be like, oh, it was inevitable. South Africa were going to win because. So they are the one who knock.
New Zealand see a couple of more bubbles left, and then they take their foot off your head because they know that you're finished anyway. England wait for one more bubble, and then South Africa wait till there's no more bubbles at all. That's basically the analogy to its final conclusion when it comes to this year's Rugby World Cup. So it's good. It's obviously there's a lot of talk about mental health in it, and the first time he really kind of broke down, realizing that he was in a fairly dark place, was actually when he was on the phone to Brian Cody, which is quite a situation to be in when you realise that you're struggling, you've got a huge uphill battle with depression, to be on the phone and Cody's on the other end, and it kind of shows a side to Cody that perhaps you don't all see, that he does understand this thing, he does have an emotional intelligence that we don't give him credit for, and just because he doesn't take shit doesn't mean that he doesn't have emotional intelligence.
Yeah, you don't last 20 years at the top in a competitive sport like that without having some level of emotional intelligence at a very evolved level, I would suggest. Right, here's what's coming up on the show today. That's going to come up on the show tomorrow. Really looking forward to that. So Sports Page is coming your way with Stephen Kelly. Going to talk football, obviously, all the way until about 8:30 this morning. And then Gregor Paul is going to join us from New Zealand to talk to us about the bloodletting that's going on. If we think it's bad here, imagine what it's like in New Zealand, where they thought 18 months ago that they just had to show up and pick up the trophy. That has not been the case. They're not playing in the final this weekend. They're playing in the third, fourth place playoff against Wales. How humiliating for an entire rugby culture. Amy O'Connor has been talking to Owen about the last season and her successful year picking up an All-Star. Sports News coming your way after around about 9:05 with Phil as well. Now, Stephen Kelly is going to join us in studio next here on OTBM. First, here's Mick McCarthy talking about his new call-ups.
Just after the Georgia game, Damien Duff on TV said that Aaron Connolly, when he looked at him playing against Tottenham, he said, this guy looks like he's ready for this level. But he did say he didn't feel Troy Parrott was. Would you disagree with that, or what's your kind of thinking about Troy Parrott?
Look, I'm not going to comment on what everybody says, even Duffer, who's a great lad and a great player. It's not for me. They've all got opinions, but I'm not going to comment on everybody's opinion on what they are. And given the fact up until now I've never called him up, you might think I pretty much agree with him. But we've got a friendly against New Zealand, so do you not think it's an opportune time, if I really want to do, is to have a look at him and see whether he can play in that game?
Yeah, we'll talk about Big Mick and the newspapers in just a minute. Stephen, good morning to you. How are you
morning.
Doing?
Yeah, very good.
Busy night nice. Last night. We'll get through the papers and we'll talk about football in a couple of minutes' time because Mick comes up in the papers, funnily enough. I'm going to start with the Irish Independent this morning. Apology for song choice accepted by Mayo backer. This is the story that just keeps on giving. So the chairman of the Mayo GAA International Supporters Foundation, an organisation that not many of us knew existed until very recently, his name is Tim O'Leary. He's an Englishman. Has received an apology from Mayo GAA over the choice of songs that were used as part of the halftime entertainment in Saturday's match between a county team selection and the Underdogs in McHale Park. So, you know, the Underdogs TV series, season two, and it was against Mayo this year that they played. But the songs they played were Money, Money, Money and Shoe the Donkey. I don't know Shoe the Donkey. Does anybody know it?
No.
No.
Yeah.
How does it go?
It's like a repetitive. It's a repetitive shoot a donkey motion, and then shoot a donkey one too. It's a dance, isn't it?
I don't know.
It's an Irish dance.
Oh, right, okay. Because obviously,
you're Patriots, are you? It only rings a mile bell. I'm sure we'll get it up.
The letter of apology stated was a light-hearted take on recent events after a county board officer referred to the businessman as a donkey in an earlier email. So that they've got $250,000, which they raised at a dinner in New York, and they're not giving it to the Mayo County Board, even though they raised it for the Mayo County Board, because they want to see where the money is going and they want to see business plans for the Centre of Excellence and the Academy. The County Board tonight apparently are going to respond to the first two letters that O'Leary has written to them about sponsorship, etc. And there's a third letter which is now made its way into the public domain, and it's in the Independent today as well, about the $150,000 that he gave them and how they've accounted for that as well. So it's fair to say relations are strained between the Mayo GAA International Supporters Foundation and the Mayo County Board. And Mayo are on the back pages almost every day at the moment, so not exactly what you want from your county. The other story headlines there, McCarthy puts faith in Kelleher ahead of his Anfield run out. So Mick McCarthy has picked Queevan Kelleher. Queevan Kelleher is going to start the game for Liverpool tonight. And Carberry doubtful for Europe. Owen was talking about that just a couple of minutes ago. Joey Carberry has an injury. JP Ferreira said he's rehabbing a knee injury picked up against Italy in August, which troubled him during the World Cup. So
was that mentioned before?
The knee injury.
Knee against Italy in August.
At the time, was it not a broken bone? Or
in the ankle area?
Yeah.
I had no idea that it was a knee injury, which is...
It was both?
Maybe it was both, but I thought it was just a kind of a one-dimensional thing, so it's obviously a bit more serious, and it's just kind of a calendar year from hell after it started so well for Joey Carberry at this point. The Irish Times leads with Gordon Darcy's column this morning. Strong stuff from him on South Africa. The headline is, South Africa, this final's Darth Vader ranged against England's Skywalker. So pretty obvious comparison there, who he thinks is the good guy and who he thinks is the bad guy. He says, I almost feel sorry for Felix Jones. At least his role in the South Africa setup isn't attack coach, because there is no attacking strategy to highlight. It's a bit of a burn from Gordon Darcy. South Africa are not even seeking to be progressive in any shape or form. Grind it out, says Razzie. Half the backline cannot catch and pass to a provincial, never mind international standard.
He's saying that. Darcy's saying that.
Yeah.
But it's not true, is it? Is it not when they try and pass it and catch it, they're actually capable of doing it and they open up teams. But they just are like pre-programmed, no, we can't do this.
I would have thought so as well. He does kind of single out Faf de Klerk as somebody who should be in with a shout of being player of the tournament, which I'd agree with, but maybe he's player of the tournament because he box kicks very effectively and actually he's part of this machine trundling down the pitch quite effectively.
There's a snipe from him now and then which keeps everybody honest though.
Yeah, that's
which
true.
Which you need if you're going to be a box kicker. You need to occasionally...
It's true. Him versus Jake Ball on Sunday morning was my particular highlight of the weekend. I love when a 5 foot something guy takes on a 7 foot guy on the pitch. It always gives me hope. He's talking here as well about Ireland, just to finish up on Darcy's thing, because he talks about where we went wrong and what needs to happen next for where do we go from here, as somebody might say. He talks about that. And
where do we go from here?
He says we will never fully know what went wrong. He says, I say this because I don't remember a full review after the 2007 or 2011 World Cups. There was an email, a quick survey, but nothing deep-rooted and most importantly anonymous. An opportunity to provide insight about the coaching setup to ensure our employers avoided making the same mistakes. So he's suggesting that after the latest quarter-final defeat, there is now an opportunity to offer the Irish players an independent, unbiased and anonymous review to know with certainty where it went wrong. He says, I'm not holding my breath this will happen, but seeking the opinions of Rory Best right down to Jordan Larmour about how they saw events from January to now should be the IRFU's primary duty. And he's probably not wrong on that front.
Yeah. So I have the Irish Daily Star on the back here. A big one is credit crunch with Mick McCarthy, who's saying Mick thinks he deserves more credit for the position that they're currently in, with one win away from qualifying for the tournament. Be that against Denmark. And then you have top player Xhaka has to give apology. So Xhaka, we all know what he did the other day, and they're saying Arsenal have told him he has to apologise to the fans, even though he hasn't done so yet, and he looks like he's still going to retain the armband and be a skipper because he thinks it's too soon to take it off him. And then in the top corner we have Man City against Southampton, the 3-1 win last night, which we were all wondering whether it was going to end up 6, 7 or 8, but 3-1, and it's a good result for City.
So back page of the Irish Sun this morning is, sorry state, Xhaka is refusing to apologise, club offer captain counselling. So granted, Xhaka needs counselling but won't apologise, telling his own fans to F off. And this one, Knickers, Mick gets in a twist. And so it's a picture of the TV, or the big screen rather, from when Denmark beat Ireland 5-1. Mick McCarthy insists everyone should be positive about Euro 2020 qualification as squeaky bum time approaches. If Ireland beat Denmark, they qualify automatically for next year's final. So a home win against Denmark, we're going to win. We're going to go through, right? And then apparently he turned his... he decided that he was going to be asking the questions of the media. Not the other way around. McCarthy said, would you have taken the situation on December 1st when the draw was made? I would. You would. Because you don't think we're that good anyway. That was the feeling before I came in. They were getting caned. They were getting caned, not us. We get those teams. There's a sigh of relief when we don't get Germany and Holland. Then we get Switzerland and Denmark. That's a real piece of piss, isn't it? There was no, great, everybody weren't dancing with their knickers in the air thinking we were just going to win. No, we're the third best team and we can win it in this. We'd all have took it. Would we?
I think if you're talking about getting to this point and only losing one game, you probably would have thought, maybe, even though we haven't exactly gone and share ourselves in glory, the Gibraltar games are the ones that jump out, that we just scrape past them, and one good performance really in against Georgia, where we've actually dominated a team and played good football. The rest of the games have been clinging on, and two good away results. Don't grant it against Denmark, but you know, going into this game, I think everybody's just fearful of what happened the last time, and we're just thinking history's going to repeat itself. And with the players that are missing, and with the way we've been performing, and our inability to keep the ball, a team like Denmark, when they do keep it and they do push, and on the big pitch in the Aviva, it probably suits them almost more than they would do in their home grounds.
It definitely feels to me like there's a couple of different factions within the Irish football media that he's talking about here, because most of the people I talk to wouldn't accept that we're no good and weren't talking the team down. It was the exact opposite of talking the team down. It was that we got fed up of Martin O'Neill talking the team down. We got fed up of Trapattoni talking the team down. And we got to the point where it was like, could somebody please come in and tell these lads that they're good at football?
Actually get more out of them, because they have got more about them.
And they've got a bit of confidence, yeah, because you've said that they're good. Now it's like you were all saying they were getting caned. There's no...
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel to me like Mick McCarthy is in charge of the group of players and setting the tone. He's like blaming the media for saying the players were no good and not actually standing in and saying, well, hang on a second now. Mm. We're going to go out and we're going to win this game because it's a home game and we're great. Like, no, there's no evidence for that, because the performance against Georgia the last time was so bad. Yeah. And I don't think he's picking the right team, and I don't think he knows exactly what he's doing. But that aside, like, I just am not impressed by if you're a player and you're looking at this, what are you thinking?
You would want them, I suppose, to be coming out saying, listen, we're good enough. We've been good enough to get ourselves into the position where we're still capable of qualifying for a major tournament, and we are good enough to put in a performance that warrants us getting there. So against Denmark, we've drawn with them away. We can beat them at home because we've proven that we can stifle these teams and we'll have enough creativity to go and score goals. That's what you want your manager saying.
This bit about, like, you don't think that we're that good anyway. You would have taken this because you don't think we're that good anyway. That was the feeling before I came in. Yeah. They were getting caned.
I think the thing is, when you say you would have taken it, there's different ways to think about it. You would have taken the sense that we're one game away from qualifying. So anybody probably would have taken that. But in the manner of we've got to that, yeah, would you have taken it? Probably not. No. That's the difference.
What if there were two games left and one was against Georgia, and you blow that opportunity to go and suddenly it's last chance saloon? Yeah. Would you have taken that two games out?
That's a good...
You know, we were in a better situation before we played Georgia than we are now.
And Georgia were there for the taking. They were so toothless, and even though they kept the ball better than us at times, we just didn't. We didn't perform, and we should have gone into that game knowing that we are capable of putting in a performance of beating them comfortably because the way we played at home.
Is Mick a good manager?
I've never worked on. I can only go. Listen, when you look at Mick on paper, what he's done at the clubs like Ipswich and how they've fallen, he knows how to set his teams up in a way of being hard to beat, and he can get the best out of certain groups of players. Is he going to be inspirational, driving us forward and completely changing the way Irish football is? I don't think so, because he still has some old school mannerism about him, but he's very capable of motivating his players, setting them up in a shape that's hard to break down. And at times throughout this campaign, I felt like he'd evolved a bit, because the Georgia game, we actually played really well. We passed the ball. Maybe Georgia weren't that great, but we were looking on it. We were and midfielders were looking for off their centre backs. They were turning. We were building up play meticulously through the midfield and out to the wingers. And I thought, oh, this is a new era for Irish football. We're going forward. It's still the same group of players, but we're actually doing things differently to what we've done before. But then we come up against the better sides, and that goes out the window. So,
I think if this Ireland campaign was an episode of Scooby-Doo, you'd take off Mick McCarthy's mask at the end and Mark O'Neill would be underneath it. It feels very, very... It does feel like a lot like deja vu. And I think the point he makes there about you didn't think we were any good, like, I think the whole point was that...
We did think we were good.
Yeah, like we were asking for a better style of play.
It might have been delusions, but at least we'd like to find out if we're any good or not.
No, completely. Like, I'm not going to, like, part of me when Martin O'Neill was hitting back at the media during that time, like, you'd always think to yourself, maybe Martin O'Neill is right. Maybe actually the way he is playing is the very best we can possibly get. And you look at his record, we did get to Euro 2016, and maybe the Denmark 5-1 was a bit of an aberration. Maybe we aren't good enough. But, like, that's the inner monologue that I'm having. That does fly in the face, but what Mick McCarthy is saying here, that
the 5-1 happens because he takes off two central midfielders and puts on, or I can't even remember the crappy managerial decisions he made at half time when he was chasing the game, and it was like that happened because he managed the situation really badly.
Yeah, we should have tried to stifle their most creative player, and if anything, we gave him more space and time on the ball.
Yeah,
and
funny enough, he ripped us apart.
Which was what happens.
At the Irish Daily Mail this morning, Leeds with events in Manchester. A pack of lies, says the headline here from Mike Keegan. Sky Doc says he did order testosterone. This is going to be an interesting couple of weeks. So we've got Dr. Richard Freeman.
Julian and McGeady came on for Myler and Arthur. So took off his central midfield and put on Wes. It was too late for that. Yeah. And McGeady, not a noted central midfielder in his career.
No, I do remember the Arthur substitution at the time. That, like, he did make a bad situation a little bit worse than what he actually did in-game at that time. That's the story about Richard Freeman.
And when are we hearing more about that? Is that an ongoing thing?
So this was a preliminary discussion yesterday. November 4th, I think, it all kicks off. So Freeman's representative, Mary O'Rourke, was speaking yesterday saying that her client had told lies. That she kind of talks about the 22 allegations that he's facing. One of them includes ordering testosterone, administering testosterone, making false claims, statements, and then asking a supplier to falsely deny the claim the order had been sent in error. The final point that he's making here is that, and it's something that he said in the past, is that Shane Sutton is the person who needed the testosterone ordered for him. And Shane Sutton has denied this. Mary O'Rourke is saying that she just needs to cross-examine Shane Sutton and everything will be fine. And there was, like, some other weird requests asked for yesterday. They asked for a screen to be put between Freeman and Sutton, which I presume is normal. And they asked for proceedings to have at most 3 hours a day. But they also asked for a screen between Freeman and the media during the proceedings, which isn't something that I've heard too often. So these are all the preliminary discussions that are going on. But the headline, pack of lies, as you can see here, I did lie in the past. I have been very liberal with the truth in the past. It's quite an admission, but it's being made by his counsel here. So
it's going to make a great BBC miniseries, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. You'd imagine that there is still a very open grave there. Who is going to be buried over the next couple of weeks is going to be quite interesting.
The Examiner this morning, high achiever Amy O'Connor and Cork, Camogie and College. We're going to hear from Amy O'Connor a little bit later on in the show. Donald Lennon, try explaining to Japanese security you have a new knee and a pair of replacement hips. He's obviously having a good time out in Japan as well. Defensive mastermind, how New Zealander John Mitchell is helping drive England to World Cup glory. It is a real Magnificent Seven-style coaching ticket that England put together for one last tour. A coaching ticket who, it appeared, were on the way out. And all sorts of stories coming out of English rugby headquarters about Eddie Jones and his management style and just how abrasive he was, and John Mitchell, how abrasive he was, and how it hadn't really worked for them, hadn't taken for them, and here they are on the verge of glory. So that is quite the comeback that they've made. And then Kieran Shannon has pointed out that there's a big game this weekend on the back of the Examiner for the women's hockey team to try and make amends for what happened to the men's hockey team last weekend.
I have the Mirror here, and the top one says Mason saves Marco, which I think is a bit of an overstatement. You know, the game was against Watford, they won 2-0. It was a bit of a grudge match considering he was the own manager, but in hindsight it's the Carabao Cup, and realistically a performance again that game is probably not going to save him. He's still going to be under the same amount of pressure coming the weekend. And then the big one is Impress Me and You're In, Rob, which is about Robbie Brady, who has been getting more minutes on the pitch now the last few weeks, and came on, had two assists during, in the game the weekend. So Mick McCarthy's kind of thrown the gauntlet down for him to come in, probably playing the New Zealand game, get some minutes under his belt, and if he puts in a good performance, he's had a chance of being in for the qualifier.
The London Times, back page of the London Times, is Jones leading towards final start for Ford. So the twin pivots, the two playmakers that they can do because they give them both game time. Owen Farrell will start and George Ford will start. That's what the team being leaked at the moment is. And then it looks like Kyle Sinclair is going to be fit. That's him with the boxing gloves there. Looks like a big man who's managed to take the stupid aggression out of his game and just start playing well. And then Cycling Doctor told a lot of lies. It's a great headline. At Lawton has been covering this story since he used to work for the Mail. And so it'll be interesting to see his take on it as well. And then Jack has been offered counselling, which is the least they can do for their captain. Given they put him on, made him captain, whipped him off with half an hour left to go. What did they expect was going to happen?
The Telegraph this morning leads with a picture of Sergio Aguero, pretty happy, smiling assassin, they say. Aguero takes City into the Carabao Cup quarterfinals, but Saints restore some pride and revealed RFU's £6 million bill for winning World Cup. Cash-strapped union has no insurance for England victory bonus payments, which is an unfortunate consequence if they do go ahead and win this weekend. It's a joke, outrage over UEFA's Bulgaria racism punishment. That's Gareth Southgate speaking. And Blues Brothers, Mountain Tomori on Chelsea's rise, two of Chelsea's young stars this season.
Last one, I have the Guardian here, and big picture is City's win against Southampton 3-1. Holiday's ease into the quarterfinals of Carabao Cup thanks to a double from Aguero against the struggling Southampton. Again, there wasn't much in this game, and I don't think anybody expected anything less than a City win. In the corner here, we're talking about I told a lot of lies, admits former British cycling doctor Freeman, which is what Ona alluded to earlier. All the details about that coming out shortly, and with all the investigation going on, it should make for some good reading, I suppose. And then the top part is just Billy Venuple has fear of the Springboks as he lays down the gauntlet. So I think he's just keen to get into this game and show his physicality, which he's not going to shy away, which is what the Springboks bring.
Yeah, he's a big alien, isn't he?
Did you see the picture of him when he was nine with the 11-year-olds? Did you see that?
No.
There's a picture of him and he looks like a 25-year-old man against these 11-year-old kids, and he's sitting there in the chair and he's like dwarfing them all, and these little boys are, and they're all looking at him and they're like, pick out who is the rugby player.
Yeah, that, certainly something that we just can't deal with that. We've got to pass the ball around these guys. So the Irish News is the last one we have for you this morning. Brannigan hopes Magpies get the rub of the green. That's a story about Kilcoo in Ulster and Republic call-up for versatile QPR ace Manning. So this is Ryan Manning. Does Ryan Manning have a place in the team, in the squad? Is he good enough?
I think Mick is going to play all these guys in the New Zealand. There's no harm. Why not play them and see how they fare? And if they seem like they're up to the challenge, not that New Zealand is going to be an amazing challenge to put them in against, but it's the atmosphere and everything goes with it. So if they can impress him, like what you said about Robbie, but I think he's going to probably go more for try tested for this game because he needs people that have played on the big level, on the big stage before.
Yeah, okay. We're going to do a tactics board. We're going to talk a little bit about some Liverpool stuff, some Man United and Spurs, and how they both separately approach the challenge against Liverpool in a moment. But it's bang on a minute past eight this morning here on OTBAM. We're talking football next. Here's Gary Breen talking about Arsenal. Have a look.
And ultimately, Richie, this is the problem, is that if you've got to name five captains, essentially it means you haven't got one.
Yeah.
Because you can talk about all the top teams who have won things. And I know that you'll have someone wearing the armband, but you'll have so many leaders around that. And certainly Arsenal have had that. And you look at Chelsea, you know, John Terry was the captain, but there were so many other leaders, Drogba, Lampard, those type of guys, check. But they have to name a five-man captain's committee of something. It is a nonsense, really. And coupled with the fact that you allow the players to choose this. Now, I have a belief for this, and I don't veer away from it. If you go into any change room in football, regardless of who wears the armband, that change room will be able to tell you who's the leader, who's the problem solver, who's the decision maker when the games happen. But still, having said that, just because he's a popular person in a change room, being popular doesn't mean you're a leader. And this is the problem that they have, is that Xhaka is a talented player. Yes, he is. But he's probably synonymous with just where Arsenal are right now, in that he can do so many things well, but he can do so many other things that he doesn't even do it to a mid-table Premier League team, let alone one that's supposedly challenging for a team.
He's been a great story. I actually spoke to him prior to going over to QPR, and he was obviously going over with a lot of optimism, and he just never got a game. It looked like he'd be out the door at QPR. Then all of a sudden, Ian Holloway comes in. I remember the story. I think it was Ian Holloway said himself, he went to watch, I think it was an under-21 or under-23 game, saw him, he was a shining light in the game, thinks, right, I'll throw him in, and he started to have a bit of success. Then, after Holloway had left, he seemed to have a little bit of time in and out of the side. He went on loan to Rotherham. It looked like he'd be out the door again. And now all of a sudden, Mark Warburton's come in and he fancies him. He's playing him in that left-back position. I've seen him playing in the 21s in a number 10 position. It's right what you say as well, Rich. He's played in a wider position as well. But he's more often than not been an attacking player, a creative player. But I think, as we're seeing now, if you are playing as a fullback, certainly the way that Warburton likes to play, and if you've seen his side, certainly the Brentford team that he's managed, the Forest, the Rangers side, it's very open and expansive football. It probably suits him being that attacking fullback, and he's having to play a lot more advanced. So it'll be interesting to see if he does get in, if he does make the final squad, if he does make the final cut, because it might be an opportunity for Mick to throw him in that New Zealand game.
Kevin Kilbane speaking to Richie on last night's Off the Ball. The full piece available on youtube.com/Off the Ball. Returning our attention back to the weekend's football, Stephen. We're looking at Spurs against Liverpool. We're going to look at perhaps how Manchester United set up against Liverpool as well, and how Spurs set up against Liverpool, with a focus on Liverpool's effectiveness at fullback. We're going to start with the Spurs game, I think.
Yeah, so Spurs and Man U both set up different ways to try and stifle their fullbacks, with them being arguably their most creative players at the moment. They're a huge part of Liverpool's play, so they need to stop them. And teams need to figure out a way to stop them, influence the match. So Tottenham set up with a 4-3-3, but the issue they were always going to have was Eriksen was playing right of the three here, and Robertson's just ability to get up and down the pitch consistently, Eriksen was never going to be able to stick with him the whole game. And at times he didn't want to. You could see, you know, his desire to want to track back is not there. He wants to play hard up the pitch, and you know, his form has dropped recently. But his ability to stay with Robertson, who's relentless in getting up and down this pitch, was inevitable that at some point he was going to get past him and run into those areas. And then the other side, you have Alexander Allen, who's just his delivery and his, you know, we talk about his creativity on the ball, and it's exceptional. I think there's only one player in the Premiership that has gotten more, I think, assists on goal or attempts on goal created by a player, and that's Kevin De Bruyne, who we talk about as being one of the best in the world. So for your fullback to be creating 30 attempts on goal at this stage in the season is just ridiculous. The quality he possesses is amazing. Again, he doesn't offer as much defensively for Liverpool, but when you get him anywhere in this side of the half, his delivery into the box is just exceptional. So the players can make runs early knowing that's going to be delivered in there. But Tottenham, I felt at times they worked well, because even if Eriksen wasn't tracking back with Robertson as he was going forward, I'll put Mane, Firmino, and I'll put Salah up here because they're really important to the way the fullbacks play, as they always want to come inside. So when Robertson was going forward, if Eriksen wasn't tracking him, Sissoko was having to come across, and then the midfield would shift. So it meant Son was getting back in here to a left side midfield, which problem is with this, even if you have four midfield, Liverpool do this, so both fullbacks are up high at the same time, so it still creates an issue. You're still overnumbered, and if you're leaving two up front, which is probably, it's the right decision because you want to occupy their centre backs, but you're just outnumbered them because their fullbacks are always getting in positions which is hard to deal with, and you're leaving two fullbacks for Tottenham, who arguably are not the best defensively, and we're getting exposed. You know, Liverpool, this playing their game and the way they've done it throughout the season has gone from strength to strength, and teams are trying to figure out ways to play against it. Tottenham did it, and they stifled them for a long period of the game, but they were still relentless, and in the end, it ended up being mistakes by the Tottenham fullbacks that allowed them to get the goals. And, you know, the difference between the fullbacks on both sides is consistency. Consistency, consistency. Liverpool, their fullback, every game, they're 7 or 8 out of 10. They don't stop. They continue to play. They continue to get the ball. They continue to look for it. They're always in the right areas. Defensively, Robertson, he tracks back, he covers, he gives the centre-backs an option as well. But Alexander Arnold's, his ability to get forward is amazing in comparison to the Tottenham fullbacks, who Rose is very good going forward and is an amazing athlete, but it's just got a mistake in him. And Aurier is probably, you know, out of 10 games, he's probably got four mistakes in him. So, you know, that consistency as a defender is of the utmost importance, and you want them to be players that perform at a high level every week. And Liverpool have that in what they have.
If you're a right back, how much of a nightmare is it going up against a left back of the quality of Robertson with Christian Eriksen in front of you?
Yeah.
Like knowing what they will offer on the left flank with Mane as well.
Yeah.
Like, so is it a personnel issue here? Is there something that Christian Eriksen could be doing differently?
It's a bit of both. Like I'd be interested to know how the communication between these two, how good that is, because if you have, which is what Liverpool do, and again, this affects their fullbacks dramatically, and I think I've spoken about before in here, is that they both have wingers / forwards that are playing on the opposite flank. So Mane is right-footed and likes to come in this way. Salah is left-footed and wants to come in this way. So if you have a right-footed winger who wants to get onto his right foot, Mane's capable of going down the line because he's so quick, but he wants to go inside a lot. If you're tracking him inside, then that just creates a space for the fullback. If you're staying with him all the way, fine, then your winger has to be capable of staying with the fullback the whole way down the pitch.
Does the right back have to go at Mane when he cuts in?
No. This is the thing. So as Mane tracks inside, there's a point where your centre back should be able to take him. But it's a communication between these two players. He, as a fullback, it's very hard for you to release him onto the centre back and tell the centre-back to take him, because the centre-back could be occupied, he could be looking around, he could be trying to see a run from midfield or a striker run off his back. So you can't really dictate to the centre-back. The centre-back has to dictate to you, I'm going to take your man. So once the centre-back says, OK, I have him, you can then stop your run and come back out to the full-back area. At that point, it could be too late with the way Robertson plays, but communication between these three is so vital to stop the way Liverpool play.
Do we have a setup in the Premier League or anywhere in the world at the moment where you have a cohesive trio here? Because it's not exactly a trio we talk about a lot in this area. Even when it comes to your right-sided centre-half and your right-back, that's often a partnership we don't talk about too often either.
It's like being the full-back, and I've played left-back and right-back for such a long time, the partnership with your centre-back is crucial, because he needs to know whether defensively, if you've got his back covered, if he instantly, if there's a midfielder or a striker running with the ball, when he can be released into that position, because he can't just go running out to close someone down. If you're wide out here, you need to be able to give him that communication to go. Likewise, when you're passing him on, the centre-back has to be the one that tells you, I'm going to take him. Because if you just pass him on to the centre-back who's already occupied, you're just giving him more problems. You're releasing yourself from an issue, but you're adding more problems to your centre-back. But at the moment, the best people is probably Liverpool.
Yeah.
Do you see the way they work? Their communication seems very good.
And despite not having a lockdown right centre half. So, like,
this is the thing. It's down to Van Dijk. As a fullback, I found the best I was able to play is when I had a centre back who I trusted. And even if he wasn't the most vocal, you knew by his position and sense and the way he played that he would cover you and do the right thing. So I played with Ledley King, and Ledley King is the best centre-back I ever played with. And his ability to get around the pitch and command the defence, and he wouldn't have been the loudest person on the pitch, but it was simple things that you knew he was there. It was just a little shout or a little communication. And that allowed me to get forward more and attack more and be in the opposing half, because you knew that his pace and his ability to defend was there, which is what these have. And Van Dijk, you know, the partnership, it's not an issue, but it's been something we've discussed because it hasn't been solid, it hasn't been nailed down because they've had injuries and Matip has been out and he's going to be out there for another few months, so they haven't found the right person to go beside him. Gomez looked like he was going to be the one that was going to take up that, and I'd say for the future he is, because he's so quick, him and Van Dijk should really complement each other very well. But he just hasn't found the form that he had last season, and he hasn't been able to nail his position down, really.
We want to talk about Alexander-Arnold in just a moment, but before that, when you talk about Ledley King and the little communication bits that he'd give you, what is that? Is it a shout? Is it a quick chat on the pitch?
It's just a shout. It's just a little communication. Like, I'd always hear, Kels, I have him, or go. So if I'm tucked in, offering him cover, at some point he would then just say go and release me to get out there, knowing that he didn't need me to be in there tracking that man. Or when I was passing the ball over, it'd be just a simple, I've got him, and then you know that he has your man and you can stay out wide. It's you know, so many times you see centre backs and full backs crossing over, and it can work because there is a time in a game where you can't let him go because you know the centre back is occupied and he can't take your man and you have to stay with him all the way. But when that happens, then your winger needs to track the other full back.
On Trent Alexander-Arnold, are we getting to a situation now where his talents are almost being wasted at fullback, or are we seeing a bit more of that because you get a bit of freedom deeper in the pitch?
You say they're being wasted. They might be wasted. People are probably clamouring for him to play centre midfield because he's such a good technician. But when you're a fullback, he has the whole game in front of him to see. He can see almost every pass, and with his distribution ability, he can find almost all those passes, which not every fullback can. So him being here, if you're playing David Beckham, would you want David Beckham down the right wing, or would you want him to be in the middle of the park? He's best suited when he was out right wing because of his crossing ability. Trent Alexander is pretty much the same. I'm not saying he's the same quality as David Beckham, but he's not far off it. His crossing ability is second to none in the league. So if you're putting him in this position, you don't often cross the ball from the middle of the park, or you don't see it. So when he's here and he's capable of whipping a ball in, but it's not just, you know, fullbacks get into these areas and they cross it in, it's kind of haphazard or it's chipped to the far post. He so often is in this area, and regardless of where he is in the half, the ball will be behind the centre-backs. And as a defender, it's horrible to think that the ball has come over your inside shoulder towards your goal. So you have to turn to face your goal. So you're running back towards your goal to try and defend it because it's always behind you. As a defender, that's a horrible position to be in because you know the striker has a run on you. So they want to go that way. You want to go the other way. You want to be set to head away, not running back towards your goal, possibly put into your own net or trying to just get out for a corner or something. So what he offers from the wide areas, I think it'd be irreplaceable. And if you were to take him out of there, they would lose a lot of what good they have. So, you know, at the moment, we're saying he's second to Crane attempts in the Premiership, apart from De Bruyne. If you put him midfield, would that increase? I don't know. I'm not too sure it would, because he's adjusted and he's settled in that position, and it suits him crossing from wide.
Fair enough. Like, when you compare the Tottenham performance at the weekend to how Manchester United set up, like, are we looking at a similar situation here where there was a plan in place that just wasn't executed to the perfect degree?
There was definitely a plan in place, because Man U, which I was surprised about, not surprised about, but impressed me about Solskjaer, was how he changed his teams recently. So he went for a back three against Liverpool and he played with two wing backs, which makes sense because it allows, when these come up high up the pitch, the three centre-backs are occupying the three front men. It's 1v1, so it's risky. And that's a risky game to play against Liverpool because of how their front three are so well. But what it does allow is your wing-backs can get pressure on these wide players earlier and get onto them when they're receiving the ball. So they're not just they're not coming out to them to try and stop them as they're on the move. As Robertson and Alexander receiving the ball, Young and Wan-Bissaka were able to be on their toes straight away, which forced him to go back the pitch a lot of the time instead of allowing them to be up the field again. They still affected the game extremely well, but this was a good tactic because it allowed them to get pressure on them earlier up the pitch instead of, you know, them coming onto them and then trying to get out there as they've already built up momentum and they're travelling forward. And the other thing that was impressive was they played with, it was like a 4-5-1, but when they had Martial and they had Rashford up front, both of those two players wanted, this is kind of the way they set up, Rashford and Martial, because they're so quick and they both have a winger in them, they occupied this space, which when that's vacated by the fullbacks, causes the two centre-backs a huge issue. If you have two quick centre-forwards who want to good run into channels, and that's going to cause Liverpool issues. And I know it was more counter-stack time in football for Man U because Liverpool had possession for the most of the time, but as a tactic, it worked really well. If you have one up front, Van Dijk all day is just going to swallow it. Regardless of who the striker is, Van Dijk is going to make mincemeat of him. He's not going to have an issue with that, especially if he has a covering centre-back. If Van Dijk has to worry about his man and then has to think about covering his centre-back as well because he has someone else, that's when you create him more of a problem. By creating him a problem, you create these a problem. Yeah. Because he can't be as effective covering these two.
It's the space behind the fullbacks.
Space behind the fullbacks.
It's the only kind of place to exploit at the moment.
There's less so on Robertson's side because of his effectiveness of getting up and down the pitch. I don't think I've seen anybody that can do it as well as he does. In the 92nd minute, he's still bombing forward and he's still offering cover. Alexander Arnold is the one that you feel if there was a chance to get in behind him, that's the side you're going to do because defensively he's not at it as much as Robertson, but he's still a young player. He's still developing that role. You know, his quality is there to see for everybody. His passing and his crossing, but defensively, he doesn't have the same amount of, I suppose, maybe experience in that position as what Robertson does. But Robertson's energy levels are just through the roof.
Is there an attacking duo or trio that you're looking at in the Premier League at the moment that could cause huge problems for this Liverpool side? Is it the Manchester United template almost that is kind of said the best shout?
It is, but then Liverpool still had the lion's share of possession. When Man City played them, that's going to be interesting to see what happens because Man City tend to always have more possession than the team. So you've got two teams that keep the ball better than anybody else and they're going against each other. And when you have a Kevin De Bruyne in this position here and you've got David Silva or if it's a Sané, who I know he's injured, but the pace he offers, and then you have Jesus and Aguero spinning off the channels, they'll occupy the two centre-forwards. So, you know, what they offer is a different attacking threat because they find pockets in behind the midfield. So the midfield for Liverpool are going to become absolutely instrumental in that game because they're going to have to try and pick up the creativity and stifle that because they will find the ball in those areas. They will have players running off the ball. And then you throw into that mix Raheem Sterling, who is probably one of the most informed players in the world, operates from the left-hand side, operates from the right-hand side, runs behind people, runs in the channels. It's going to make for an unbelievable game because you've got two managers who tactically are on point every game and have the players that can do exactly what they want them to do, but they're going up against it. They want to do the same to each other. So that game for me is going to be absolutely fascinating to watch from a tactical point of view, but also from how Liverpool are going to try and stop City playing because their creativity in the midfield areas is a lot more than what Liverpool has.
Just on a final point then, before we leave the tactics board, Stephen, the midfield movement, is there anything to write home about when it comes to that? Is it a very fundamental midfield three for Liverpool? Is it the way most midfield threes play at the moment? I know we got into this yesterday in terms of personnel, so it varies from week to week. I appreciate it.
I think it's a bit more rigid than what other teams have because they don't have that standout creative player. They don't have that one player that you would say is number 10 that's going to sit behind the front and pull strings and find those eye-of-the-needle passes. They don't seem to have that, but what they do have is in a very effective tree that can stop people playing, that get on the ball. They still pass forward, they still drive on. Henderson scored the weekend. They show that they have the quality to get into those areas, but they're more of a unit in the sense of they stifle teams, they break them down, they give Liverpool a platform to play on because what they have in their front, the fullbacks and the front three is five players that know how to attack and how to get forward in waves constantly and cause teams extreme problems. But the difference with City is City's creativity is breathtaking to watch at times. We watch some of the intricate play they have. I mean, you have someone like Silva, the two Silvas, and De Bruyne playing the same team and they're all on form. That's going to offer Liverpool something they haven't faced before. And, you know, they've been winning ugly slightly. They haven't been running over teams. And we've been saying it's a sign of a very good side that they can win games and not be at their best. They'll need to be at their best to beat City.
Yeah, they certainly will. Let's go back to Ireland. We're going to chat a bit more about international football in a moment. A bit more about hammerings as well on the back of the 9-0 drubbing that Leicester City gave Southampton last Friday night. But before that, here is Mick McCarthy chatting about the vibe in the Ireland squad.
Have you looked back at the Switzerland game since that nightmaker?
Yes.
You did speak about the players not performing well and passing poorly, not being able to pass.
I said we didn't pass it to each other, yeah, that's what I said.
What was that down to now that you've had a chance to look back at the game?
Well, I think probably the fact that they were particularly good in the first half. You always have to give credit to the opposition as well. It's not always just about one team not playing as well as we can. And I thought when we settled down and we played much better in the second half, and it was a much better performance with the ball. So I don't know. I don't put it down to anything other than that they were playing against a very good side who pressed us and closed us down.
There is a feeling maybe that some players feel that they will get picked no matter how they perform. Do you think maybe that some players should be worried for their positions in the team coming into the Denmark game?
Bearing in mind you seem to speak to everybody, who are the players who seem to think they're going to get picked and no matter how they perform?
Well, there will be a feel that there is players maybe that haven't been playing well in the last couple of games that maybe they should feel that they're placed under threat, but maybe that you won't get good performance out of players if they don't feel that there's some other guy coming behind them.
Well, you know, I pick the team where I think on merit and where I think things should play and deserve to play. And I guess all the players who are not playing, and I'd have been one the same if, not that it happened too often, I'd always be thinking I should be playing. But that's for me to pick the side, isn't it? Not them.
Yeah, it is for Mick McCarthy to pick the side. 8:21 this morning, we're talking about the Republic of Ireland and their chances. This, in fairness to Mick McCarthy, he doesn't want to do this. There was a sponsors day with SSE Airtricity, and so normally he doesn't make this big announcement the way the old school. Certainly O'Neill always took the opportunity to have this press conference. Everybody was in, everybody was happy, it was miles from the game, none of the questions mattered. This time it's the last game.
Yeah.
It's potentially his last ever game as manager of Ireland, because he ain't going to get the job a third time. So it's a big game and there must be a bit of pressure on him.
Yeah, I'm sure he wouldn't have wanted to do this, I don't think, this far in advance of the game, because you're just, all you're doing is now is put more pressure on all the quotes and everything he said is going to be scrutinised from now till the match, and then by the time it comes around they're going to be asking questions based on what he's answered now. So it's not an easy position for him to be in going into the game. I'm sure he just wants to focus on the match.
So I didn't actually, Dan McDonald explained that at this stage you need to fax the club or email the club or let the club know somehow, however telecommunications work, that these players are being considered for call up to the squad. So that's what the extended squad actually, there is a function to it.
Yeah, no, normally I think the club would get an email saying this player is in contention to be in the squad, be prepared to know that he could be going on international duty. But then he's had to name the squad now, which is different because he's actually told the players they're in the squad, they could be cut then.
The extended 35-man squad, yeah. So which is, you know, a bit ridiculous, but it is what it is. Look, I mean, I don't know if we're going to beat Denmark. I don't feel particularly confident that we're going to beat Denmark at home at this stage.
I know, it's one of those where you feel like, I don't know whether I'm more hopeful that we're going to beat them, because I just want us to see us go through. I'd love to see us get a big home win and have the atmosphere. And the thoughts of having a tournament that's, you know, basically a home nations tournament for us, it's going to be on our doorstep, and for us not to be in it would be such a catastrophic error for to not to be there. So if we have an opportunity to beat them, I'm hopeful that we can win it. I don't know whether I'm that confident we're going to win it, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I think something very similar. 8:23 this morning, you're watching OTB AM, the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Wall. Kevin Kane says, I'm delighted for Manning. Thoughts on Malumbi not making it? He should have played versus New Zealand, in my opinion.
I'm not sure. Like I said, this New Zealand game, it's a great chance for Mick to play players, but I would have thought he's only going to play players that he feels realistically have a chance of being involved in the next match, because that's all he's looking at. He's not looking at bringing players in that are, you know, are for the future. And I know that sounds silly, but this game is of the utmost importance. So he wants to have players that he feels, if they perform well in this game, they might have an impact for us in the Denmark game. And I presume he thought Mullumby is just not there yet.
One of the things that came up over the course of the week was how teams recover from the 9-0 drubbing that Southampton had at the weekend. What's your worst experience of drubbing?
I was on the bench for the game against Germany when we got hammered, but I didn't play. For games I've played in, I think I've lost a couple, maybe four or five, and it's just your...
Never nine.
No, well, obviously, in the history books, I couldn't be nine unless I played one of those games, but no, never nine. And it's, I think what in the game, and if it starts off badly and you're playing against a very good side and you just think, oh God, we're in for a tough day, the mindset from everybody is, if you can see a couple of goals earlier, right, that's it, lock up shop, close down, get together, stop them scoring more goals, don't let this get embarrassing. And that as well as a defender, and that's what's said between you on the pitch. On the pitch, you're saying to your, like, you're just, no more goals, no more goals, no more goals. Fortunately, a couple more might go in, but that's your mindset. 9-0 is... like Southampton there were devoid of any sort of shape, any form. They're lackluster defending. They're like all the goals could have possibly. Like, don't get me wrong. There's a few very good goals. Madison's free kick, some great exceptional pieces. But when you look at it and break it down, crossing into the box, men not being marked. Little chip, third man runs into the box, men not being marked. Like, we talk about communication being absolutely vital in football. There was no communication between teams. People were running off the backs of their players and they were just turning around and throwing their hands up in the air as if, like, oh, you're supposed to be marking him. Well, if you're supposed to be marking him, tell him. It was shameful that they didn't get it together at some point to look like they could stop them, because Leicester could have won that game 12-13-0.
Being on the bench for the 6-1 drubbing, like, we were talking about the guys that came on at halftime and the kind of wreckage that then ensued in the 5-1 against Denmark. Kind of sitting there watching it all unfold in front of you, what is that emotion like? Because to some people it would be like, well, at least I'm not out there. But I presume to a professional footballer, that's not exactly the attitude you'd have.
No, you want to play every game. And even if the team have been beating, you kind of feel like, I can do something more to stop that happening. And that's just your mindset, because you want to be on the pitch at all times. But the Ireland game against Germany, it was a combination of two things. It was the world champ. They went on to be the world champions. So at the time, they were probably the best Germany had been for a long, long time. And what sticks in my mind, and to this day, I feel like it was such a shame he didn't get to play in the World Cup, was Marco Reus. He was exceptional. I mean, I've seen a lot of live football, obviously, and that was one of the best performances I've seen live from any player. It was just breathtaking to watch, and I thought, wow, that's going for full. Toni Kroos was unbelievable. Lamb was, I've never seen a player, he didn't give the ball away. So they beat us, they were comfortable, and they went on to win it. I played in the next game in Germany, where they beat us 3-0 or 3-4-0, I think it was. And we were better organised, had a more of a shape about us. You know, we knew what we were going into in some extent, so we counterattacked them a bit better, and we set up an information that we didn't let them just run all over us. But that game afterwards, there was, you know, a lot to be said, and we were going into the farewell, and so you knew straight away there was a game that we could turn around in a sense that we were going to get a win in the back. But I think that was the end of it for Trapattoni.
Yeah, it definitely felt, and I'm sure you felt it as well, many times during Trapattoni's era, he was fairly patronising towards the players in terms of the qualities of the players. Like, I don't want to say a 6-1 defeat ever vindicates a manager, but like, I wondered if it ever kind of said to him, well, I told you guys so, or whatever, when it came to the media, that, like, ultimately there was a blame to be had there in terms of how Ireland set up, in terms of how he kind of approached that himself, that if the belief wasn't there from the dugout, stuff. Then...
Yeah.
Then where can it actually come from?
I think the thing is, though, with Trapattoni, like I said, I played quite a lot under him, and... You know, we got to the European Championships. I didn't play in the European Championships, which was a sticking point for me. I should have. At some point, I'd been playing with my club, and it was extremely frustrating. The most frustrating I've ever been in my career would be not getting time to play in that tournament. But then on the back of that, then we lost 6-1 to Germany. So I'd gone from the tournament and not playing and us being pretty poor over there and not getting a win and losing every game, not playing a minute and playing 9 games in the qualifiers to get us there, but then not getting a minute over there, which is frustrating. And then on the back of that, to come into the next campaign and play against Germany and get hammered. So then, and I was on the bench again, so I was like, oh, so what do I have to do? You know, in the last 4 games, you've conceded how many goals, and I'm a player that's played in the Russia game that helped us get us there, played in the 4-0 win over in Estonia that helped us get us there. So you're kind of like feeling, it can be a frustrating time and it can spill over. But, and as from the manager's point of view, yeah, there was a sense of, you know, he set up us in a way because he'd had great teams, he'd had unbelievable teams, like the likes of Bayern Munich and Juventus and wherever. So there was a sense that he didn't feel we were as good as those teams, so he set up in a way that we could be effective. But if you looked at that squad now to the current squad, how would you judge us? You know, you're talking about players, Robbie Keane, Damien Duff.
John O'Shea.
Yeah, John O'Shea, Richard Dunn, Shay Given, you know, myself, Keith Andrews. Everybody was playing in the Premiership constantly for their teams. So that's...
How did you get out of the team? What happened?
What was
the Euros like?
Basically, when I played in the games I played in, there was probably an injury or a suspension for someone. So I came in and played and did well, but then the manager would just revert back to his starting 11.
Always right back?
Both. Left back.
Right and left back.
Oh, left back and right back, yeah. Left back and right back, so... Yeah, I played pretty much. I'd say I probably played just as much left back as I did right back in the qualifications.
And so in the tournament, the full backs are... Ward and O'Shea.
O'Shea, yeah. 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 And yeah, they know.
But O'Shea should have been playing centre back at that stage.
Yeah, should have been, yeah. 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 Oh, no, I should. I 100% should have played right back in the tournament. I feel. I've gone on the. I played 30 something games for Fulham that season, maybe 40 in cup competitions. Had a really good campaign, you know, the year before. Had done well, and you know, I've been playing consistently in the Premiership, so it was, for me not to have played was extremely frustrating, and I felt I definitely deserved a place in the team, but sure, that's what happened. And you know, for the last game where we'd obviously out of the tournament and there was a chance to change it, and he stuck with the same players again instead of giving the players that had, you know, even if he didn't want to make wholesale changes and change the whole team, you know, he should have at some point thought, you know what, there's a lot of players that have been involved that have had more contribution to us getting here than what I've given them. So we should have given it an opportunity.
Against, that was the Italian game.
Italian game, yeah.
And it's not like...
No, it didn't go down well on any.
It didn't make any difference.
No, made no difference whatsoever, yeah.
Was that an annoyed camp very early on?
Yeah, I think... So I think you spoke to Keith about it before, haven't you? About the how long we were in camp for and it was just double sessions. And don't get me wrong, it's great being around the Irish lads and you're going into a major tournament, there's a huge buzz about it, but there was a sense of it was too much time before we went to the tournament. It would have been better broken up, I think, instead of being very full on.
And there was a training camp in Italy.
There was a training camp in Ireland, then in Italy.
Yeah.
And then a week or so before the tournament, we went to the tournament as well. So it was a long time together, and I suppose cabin fever was setting in, and you were losing... Not losing the excitement when we got to Poland, you know, it, all of that kind of changed, but you felt that it was almost too intense before we got there.
But the team never changed, really.
No.
Like, everybody knew exactly what the first team was going to be, so there was no opportunity.
No.
Even if you played well in training, it didn't make any difference.
Well, like I said, even if you played well in the game, so, you know, considering, I think there was nine games I think I played in for the qualifiers to get there, which is most of them, basically.
And is there a conversation that happens with Trapp or with Tardelli or anybody saying, listen, this is the direction we're going, Stephen?
Well, considering they don't speak English, no, there's not much of a conversation at all. So, no. I think...
Brady around the camp at that stage, or is he gone? Is he still there?
I think Liam was still there. But, yeah, no. It was so widely publicised what people thought happened afterwards, and it was, like, frustration spilled over. But, you know, there's a sense of just... The way they would... No, I wasn't even the manager. Trapattoni was different. I think he understood slightly more and he was a bit more delicate in the way he put things, even though he's quite stern and robust at times. He was still a bit more approachable, even though, again, his English was very poor and, you know, you couldn't really have a conversation with him and tell him exactly how you're feeling. But it was Sardelli who was a little bit more kind of dismissive about things, and that's kind of...
Why was that? Or like, was that just the way he was? Was he always like that, or did that change?
No, maybe because he was a World Cup winner, he felt he could be dismissive. I don't know.
Yeah. Which is like an unusual situation. We obviously thought at the time that this is a great big name to bring in, but actually because of their kind of success, the playing success, was it a situation where they looked down on players, or is that putting it a bit too harshly?
Not Trapattoni. I don't think he didn't. He was, again, I think he was respectful and he just felt this was his best way of getting a performance over. So he wasn't, he didn't look down. Tardelli, on the other hand, afraid of what I want to say here. I think to an extent he was a little bit kind of, if you know, none of us were at the level that he, like none of us have ever won a World Cup. So, you know, for him, we probably felt that we were below what he'd set standard for himself.
Mm. Which isn't the way a coach should be, or any backroom team.
I missed it. So, what happened?
So after the game, I think I went to speak to them just to ask them about, you know, am I going to play now? We've lost, type thing. And then
after this is the second game.
Yeah, the second game. We were about to travel to the Faroe Islands, and I just kind of said, "Listen, making a case for myself, I feel like I deserve an opportunity."
Sorry, is this after the Germany game?
After Germany game.
Okay, right. So you've sat through the Euro, said nothing.
Yep.
Sat through the 6-1, said nothing.
Yes.
Finally, you're like, I'm going to
say playing
something.
The Faroe Islands, so it's not like a risk put me in against them. You know, played a couple of hundred Premiership games and playing against the Faroe Islands. I think I could handle myself. So I think I went to speak to them and say, listen, blah, 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 I feel like I should play. you know, I think you all probably know me around here. I'm not exactly the argumentative type person. I can stand my ground and I'm more than capable of looking after myself, but I'd always do things respectfully and manfully.
So you weren't shouting the odds?
No. And then it was just the way Tardelli was, and that was it. It was just, he was very dismissive and just, yeah, it was a frustrating time. Like I said,
there's no actual conversation. You go in and say, here, listen, I want to play, and he's like...
Yeah, basically.
Just kind of waving you away.
Mm, pretty much, yeah.
Not a great moment, I would
suspect. No, not at all, no. And like I said, extremely frustrating, and just, you know, when you're in that position as a player and someone that's been... I think... That was frustrating, but then what happened afterwards, I think when they questioned my commitment to Ireland stuff and all and different things like that, and I'm going, are you kidding me? I've literally like played for Ireland since I was 16 years of age. I'd gone something like 4 years and not missed a qualifier, even though I'd probably only played in like 5 of them. You know, so, you know, for people to question your commitment to your country when all you've ever been is committed to Ireland and playing for Ireland, and it's probably been the pinnacle and the best moments of my career of being playing for Ireland, in the sense of that's what I would, like I said, I supported teams when I was a kid growing up, but I supported Ireland more than I supported any of those teams. So it was never me, like, if I'd have put on a Liverpool jersey when I was a kid growing up, it would have been great, but, you know, it wouldn't have been like Steven Gerrard playing for Liverpool. It was me playing for Ireland was that.
Yeah. So did he say anything? Did he actually speak? Or was it just gesticulation?
Not really. It was more just like, I think it was like, Trapattoni was trying to engage a little bit, but then it was Tardelli was just dismissive and, yeah, just kind of said, waved it away and was like, basically he wasn't interested. So, yeah.
What's the timeline then of him coming out saying that stuff about you?
That was after the farewell. And so then...
So there's still a possibility that you worked together, but he's questioning...
Yeah, no, I still worked together. And then I got called up to a squad, and then I think he left me out of a squad. And I was at Reading at the time. We were in the Premiership, still in the Premiership. And I think I was left out of a squad, and then he came out. I think when I was left out of the squad, I think the press asked him why I was left out. And I think they said, oh, it was commitment or something.
All right.
Yeah.
And so when you're reading that, what are you thinking?
Oh, I was fuming, like, absolutely fuming. Like, oh, like... Beyond rage. I mean, like I said, for myself, my wife Helga, who we've been together since we were 17, and she's seen how much effort and time I've put into playing for Ireland and coming home for every game and being disappointed not to play or whatever it's been. But yeah, I'd always turn up, I'd always keep coming. And, you know, people might say, oh, you're playing for your country, you should. But it gets to a point if you're a professional footballer where
you want to play.
You want to play.
Yeah.
So, but if you're still willing to come, even though you're not guaranteed, that says a lot more than the play. Like, I think it's harder to come as a player that's not guaranteed to play than the player that's going to play.
How did you get back in then? Did Trapattoni bring you back in?
I picked back in, yeah. Well,
right,
yeah.
Okay. And was that okay? That was.
I just got on with it. Listen, we wouldn't have had much conversation with him in the first place.
Okay, so there was no kind of clear the air to Tardelli?
No, because, like I said, you didn't really speak to them that often because they didn't speak that good English. So when you came in the squad, it was just basically the same.
Right.
And then they were gone then.
And what about O'Neill? How did the O'Neill thing end?
Just, I think I got injured. Basically, I got injured and that was kind of it. Like, there was no... But, see, Ireland's a funny one for me because, like, I've spent my whole life wanting to play for Ireland and playing for Ireland and being in from 16 to 32. So when you do give that much time to your country and you literally obliquely, and I would do anything to play for Ireland. If Ireland called me now, I'd play for Ireland now. I don't care. I wouldn't care. So... You know, and I never officially retired because I just thought one of those things that why would you ever say close the door on something that you would still happily do or want to do? I don't think that's that never made sense for me. So, but yeah, when it came to the end, it was just basically I got picked in a couple of squads. I got picked in the first few squads of O'Neill's reign and Keane came in, played a few games, and then I got injured at my club. So I was called up but missed it because I was injured and then stopped getting called up and that was it.
Right.
But that was it. Like, there was no communication, no talk, no phone call, no nothing from anybody involved in Ireland. And I don't hold grudges against it. But when you ask to talk about it, it makes you frustrated thinking that you're...
That's pretty raw.
Well, if you've committed that much time to a country and a club and you don't have a phone call to say thanks very much for your services or we appreciate everything you've done or, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah, look, listen.
At any point.
We've gone a different direction.
But from nobody involved. Like, that's frustrating.
I can see how that might be a bit annoying, all right?
Yeah, slightly.
Yeah, all right. And with O'Neill, there's no specific individual grudge. It's more a system doesn't work.
He was the manager at the time. You know what I mean, he manager picks the team based on... Listen, I've been around enough managers to know that sometimes a manager picks a player with you and... You get on with it. You try your best and you play to the level of your ability to force your way into the team or make it. But if a manager doesn't pick, it doesn't pick. What can you do? It's all opinions, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. It's a game of opinions, all right. It's 8:40 this morning. You're watching OTBM, the Sports Breakfast Show from Off The Ball. We're talking rugby with Gregor Paul next to get the bloodletting from New Zealand going. Here's Ronan O'Gara from last night's Off the Ball, chatting about England.
Where England, I suppose, have really impressed people has been, and Eddie Jones in that regard, his capacity to change up the slate to Willagie Farrell after putting 46 points in Australia to a superior performance with a midfield of Ford, Farrell and Tuilagi for the semi-final. So there could be a surprise before even the team is announced to start the final. And what midfield will he go with? Because Slade is a left-foot option as well in terms of, turning the South African backs, because I think there are opportunities for England by going after South Africa's back three. I think that's, Colby is a brilliant attacker, but defensively or aerial contest would be a weakness from my point of view.
Yeah, so Brian O'Driscoll obviously was on the show yesterday and he was saying that he actually hoped that England did end up winning it because they were the best team left in the competition. A slightly controversial remark around these parts. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about an England victory?
Not amazing. You put it into the context of South Africa and it's a bit more palatable, I think it's fair to say.
I mean, look, Razzie Erasmus' short time in Ireland was great. He was like a high wattage individual who came in at an unbelievably difficult time and turned things around and has left an indelible mark on one of the most important provinces in the country. Like, I would be very happy for him. I'd be very happy for Felix Jones. But that's where my happiness would stop if South Africa were to win at the weekend.
Yeah, it's tough to make any kind of... Is there anybody else? Is there anybody else that you could actually be kind of overjoyed for from a South African perspective? Go through the list of English people you'd be overjoyed for.
I mean...
It's actually 2-0.
it'd be good for Andy Farrell to have his son a World Cup winner, wouldn't it?
What can you learn? Owen Farrell brought in as a backroom member to Team Ireland before his England rugby career is over. Oh, I don't know. It's nobody wins.
You'd be happy for Austin Healy and the swan diving guy, and you'd be happy for Neil Back, and you'd be happy for Tim Rodber, who kicked all those penalties against Munster for Northampton back in the day.
You'd certainly be happy for Neil Back.
Martin Johnson.
He's the one I'd be, and Martin. Martin Johnson turned out to be a nice guy.
He's a lovely guy. Neil Back turned out to be a lovely guy.
Chris Ashton actually turned out to be a pretty nice guy. If you listen to his podcast, comes across as actually a gentleman. So maybe in a couple of years' time when all these English players retire, we'll be like, 15 gentlemen beat 15 horrible men from South Africa.
Ruffians.
And it was
that's how that works.
A win for humanity.
Have you seen anything from New Zealand about their bloodletting? I mean, I'm interested to see exactly how nasty it gets in New Zealand after they lose a World Cup.
But I just saw the front of the New Zealand Herald on Sunday, where it was like just a blank page, and then it was like, New Zealand are out of the World Cup. If you want to read more, go to the sports section in tiny writing. But it was basically just
a black page.
A black page, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was like very dramatic. Very, very melodramatic and over the top.
Way too over the top, especially when they were clearly second best. If Ireland lost in that manner, if Ireland had beaten the All Blacks and went down to England, there might have been like confetti on the front pages of Irish newspapers.
Celebrating the fact that we reached semi-final.
Yeah.
The monkey is off our backs finally.
The monkey is off the back. The immortality had been reached. But not for New Zealand people. Not for them. And I don't think they covered themselves in a lot of glory afterwards. Like Steve Hansen's comments, basically calling a journalist outside for a couple of moments. Like that was. And it wasn't even a question for him. It was a question for Kieran Reid.
I know. Kieran Reid's a big man who's able to front up for himself and answer his own questions. He did not need help from his buddy sitting beside him who's like finishing up right now. I mean, Steve Hansen blew it. 18 months ago, as Chris Ratu told us on the show, they expected that they were going to waltz to a World Cup. So he blew it. He inherited a World Cup winning team with McCaw and Carter, had them both fit for the entire World Cup 4 years ago, and then had a World Cup winning squad and team and momentum heading into the World Cup, and he blew it. So for the rest of his life, he's going to have to live with the fact that he is one of those coaches who didn't win a second World Cup.
How does he not blow it? Is it personnel? Is it not the overhaul they did from Dublin last year? Or is that the thing that got him to the point where they looked like a dominant team and actually wasn't enough of an evolution?
Team selection right. Don't pick Barrett in the back row. Don't move Sevilla across the back row. Maybe don't overthink things. Like, maybe don't get too carried away with the win against Ireland. Like, Clearly, they turned Ireland into some kind of bogeyman, which was completely unnecessary. Maybe they thought they were going to play us in the final. They probably did think that we were going to get to the final a year ago.
Maybe we've got a skewed vision of Rugby World Cups. You know that's the statistic that was going through the rounds?
I clearly do, but go on.
That every team who had beaten us had failed to win their next game in the Rugby World Cup.
Ever?
Ever.
Oh, right. And it's continued?
It's continued.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. What a great stat.
So maybe, and this is my theory, that the World Cup view is skewed and actually everybody just really rates Ireland as a World Cup team.
Stupidly.
Everybody all around the world is like, this is their year. This is their year. We beat Ireland, we win the World Cup. And then every single time they get it wrong as well as we do.
Is that right? So going back.
Argentina.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wales.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the statistics include 2007. I presume it didn't. I presume it was only quarterfinals. Yeah. France. Gone in the semis.
Right. And well, that's back to 03, 99. Argentina beat us in Lons. I presume they went out in the next game.
Didn't get out of the group. It was New Zealand in 05.
Australia don't. Australia 91 don't.
So maybe it's that they don't actually want to win the World Cup.
Australia 91 did. So, apart from them, everybody since 1991.
That's your stat. That's your stat right there.
What's 95? I can't actually.
In New Zealand and France both hammer us. So it's, I assume the stat is around New Zealand not winning the World Cup, so. Neither did France. Beat Ireland, you don't win the World Cup. That's your very snappy statistic right there.
I was staying, when I was in Japan, I was staying in the same hotel as those, I already mentioned this, but like the morning after they'd beaten the Japanese and knocked them out, Razzie was just in the reception area and his smile was literally lighting up the whole place. Like everybody was coming over saying thanks and he was so happy.
He always looks like a CEO who sold his company for $1 billion.
He does, doesn't he? And it's like, it's all gravy after this. And it feels a little bit like that. Like,
here's a question for you. Who is the Springbok you would least like to take on in a fight?
Eben Esabet. Come on.
Like,
it's not close.
It is close.
Is it?
RG Snyman.
I mean, okay, he's the wildling looking.
Yeah.
Dude. Yeah. Still think.
Esabet would probably do a bit of damage as well. He'd leave a marker or two. But I'd rather fight him than RG Snyman.
Okay. we can pack you on a plane and you can be the sacrificial lamb for post match celebration. They would eat you.
It wouldn't be much of a meal.
8:47 a.m. this morning here on OTBAM. Let's have a look at this. It's Ronan O'Gara talking about how happy he is for Felix Jones. Have a look.
It'd be a great experience. Obviously, I think he's a consultant with South Africa, obviously, but he's part of the full time staff. So that experience would be absolutely fascinating for him, and it's brilliant for him because. At that age, it's just going to accelerate his development hugely. And obviously, Razzie has a massive amount of faith in him and likes his ideas. And you can only be delighted for him because it didn't end up well at Munster. And one door closes and a bigger door opens, yeah. And he's kicking it down. And that would be his personality. So fair play to him.
Have you had much contact with him since your own?
No, I don't, or? Because as you say, I didn't realise. I'm 42, he's 32, so I was going out another door when he was coming in as a plane. So I had a good few games with him, and his attitude was always great. And I think he has a very open and growth mindset about him. So you forget really how young you at 32 in terms of coaching, but what experience for him, you know, even if he's, they had their coaching probably ticket obviously long established, but for them to take him on board at a late stage, it speaks volumes for Felix.
Yeah, it really does, and you hope that some big gig awaits, or some second in command gig at one of the big French clubs or an English club, or maybe there's a role for him back in Irish rugby. But actually, maybe the best thing right now is to go out and see the world and come back with all your plans fully formed.
Yeah, it's a good point that you made yesterday when we had O'Driscoll on about how we've got a seemingly good collection of coaches all around the world because they've been around the world and we are missing out on that.
Leave. Yeah.
Yeah, we're missing out on that when it comes to our players at the moment. So, like, we were having this conversation a bit on Friday, and I really do think that if we are going to crystallise Irish rugby down to a Rugby World Cup, the best thing to do is to open the gates and to let people go. But Irish rugby values more than just the Rugby World Cup. It does value the Six Nations. And if you do want to win a Six Nations every now and then, if you do want to win a Grand Slam between now and the next World Cup, we probably do need to keep our players in the country because it's mid-season. Whereas the Rugby World Cup has its own siphoned off period, its own pre-season, and that, the whole issues that the Premiership delivers upon England, is they evaporate for the Rugby World Cup. And that is the reason, one of the reasons why we don't want our players going abroad, is because they'll get battered and bruised.
Clubs are certainly reaching a point now where they have enough money and depth that they're able to not flog their own players, because they realise that player load is important. And so if you're going to be in the grand final in the Premiership or the top 14, that you need your players to be a little bit rested, or at least game sharpened, as opposed to completely flogged to death at the end of the season. So I think that player management issue is less pronounced than it would have been. I don't think that they're going to be completely flogged the way they were.
Well, I think it's more pronounced in Ireland, because we big up these Heineken Champions Cup games when the players from England or France are being flogged, because they care about the game that happened the week before a hell of a lot more than the game.
My point is that the squads have got bigger to the point where...
That's true as well.
So, look, it's not fixed. It's not perfect, but it's certainly way better than it was 5 years ago or 8 years ago.
Do you open the door? If you're Devin Issafore now, do you open the doors?
Look, I think that I think you have to do a proper analysis of how many players would go. So you divide your players into tiers, the ones you don't want to go, the ones you think would actually benefit from a couple of years away, the ones who you'd like to keep but aren't sure they're going to have any game time here, so off you go and get some game time. And then the next generation of players who are going to have 2.5-3 years playing frontline rugby for Leinster, Munster, Connacht and Ulster, and who'll benefit from playing in the European Cup every year, who wouldn't get that opportunity if... So if you're a Leinster, for example, and you let your five back rowers who were first choice 18 months ago all go at that stage, right? Suddenly you've got five young players coming through who've all had 18 months of first team experience. The likelihood is you don't win a European Cup and reach a European Cup semi-final. Almost certainly you don't.
Certainly you sacrificed all that.
Yeah. How much of it though? How much of all of it? Like, do they make a quarter-final? Are they obliterated in every game? Is it completely ruination to their confidence? And so therefore, do you keep one of the five or two of the five, and the other three are guaranteed game time?
Well, by opening the doors, you're not necessarily sending people off. You're just changing the policy and not picking you for the Irish team. So the allure of staying in Ireland is lessened. So, like, what are you offering the top tier players? Because,
well, maybe you're not offering them anything like the money that they're going to get abroad until the final 18 months of the pre-World Cup build-up, at which point you're going, okay, we'll match whatever contract you have. But we've saved this money for the first 2.5 years of the 4 years, and we're going to backload the contract. And if you're good, we'll bring you back. And if you're not good, enjoy the money.
It's a win-win.
Well, we've realised that you weren't going to be... We haven't footed the bill for you not making it to the end.
But you can still come and play for Ireland in the Rugby World Cup. We just won't have full control over you for the 18 months leading up to the World Cup.
Maybe you don't pick them at all for the Six Nations. So you're forcing yourself to give people who wouldn't otherwise get that experience the opportunity in the Six Nations. And then, like, so you do exactly what South Africa did. South Africa had this very hard and fast rule that there's no way you were playing unless you're playing in South Africa. And they got beaten and beaten and beaten and beaten and hammered. Razi comes in and goes, about that, lads. It's a World Cup to win here. Let's change things. They changed it, and suddenly they got the best team, second best team in the world. Like, maybe the best.
Yeah. It's
There's a model there.
A lot to be said. But yeah, getting back to Felix Jones, you'd love to see him back on our shores eventually. But now is not that time. All the jobs are filled at this point. His heart probably feels like it belongs in Munster, and we don't know fully what went on.
Maybe not. Like, I mean, he's from Sutton or Holt, isn't he?
That's
dope.
Like, in terms of his coaching career, and also at the moment, in terms of how Leinster is full up, I would say at the moment there's no avenues in that Munster or Leinster. Give it a couple of seasons. Who knows how wildly successful this.
The other thing I would do if I was the IRFU is I would be like siphoning off the biggest salaries for coaches, so that you can have amazing coaching tickets at the four provinces. You only have four gigs, but you've got four assistant coaches or head coaches and managers, and I would be desperately trying to get the world's best coaching talent to come there, and I would be matching whatever the money is available anywhere else for that, because ultimately the coaching is the thing that's going to bring the young players through the fastest. That and game time. But if you've got world-class coaching tickets...
It seems that they're working on that at the moment. Like Larkham, Lancaster, fairly good appointments over the last few years.
Yeah, yeah. But you can't let that go, and you can't rest on your laurels, and you've got to make sure that Connacht and Ulster have exactly the same thing too. So, okay, let's move on. It's 8.55, just turned 8.55 this morning. Yesterday afternoon, Cork Camogie star Amy O'Connor popped into the studio to celebrate the announcement that Littlewoods Ireland are renewing their sponsorship of the All-Ireland Senior Hurling Championships and the All-Ireland Camogie Leagues for the next three seasons until 2022. Here's how we get on.
All right, I'm delighted to say that Cork star Amy O'Connor is back with us in the studio. You're welcome back.
Thanks, brilliant.
How are you keeping?
Good, how are you?
All good. We were just chatting off air there about a little bit of a lack of luck on the club front, and I was going to start off on a bad note as well when it comes to the inter-county stuff, so we may as well get that out of the way straight away. An All-Ireland semi-final this year, Galway, a point of a difference in it in the end. Are you over it yet? Is it something that after the previous 2 years of success that it's easier to take or harder to take?
No, it's definitely harder to take. The 1 point is very difficult to take, especially because we were so bad on the day. Like I always say, you'd get away with maybe three or four players having a bad day. We probably had 12 and 13 players had an off day that day, and it's just so happened that everyone's off day came on the same day, which is very frustrating. And yeah, I was very disappointed. But Galway were better than us on the day, and we can't have any complaints. They were the better team.
Going for a three in a row obviously requires a huge level of consistent perfection. Was that the first time that you felt that you had a dozen or so players who were below par, or had you managed to get through that on previous occasions over the last 3 years?
I'm not really sure. It is obviously very difficult to go for the three in a row. And as I say, we had too many people who had an off day on the same day. Like, everyone is going to have an off day at some stage. And it just so happened that all of us had an off day on the same day. So that was very frustrating, yeah.
And are you kind of sitting there in the dressing room afterwards saying to yourself, it's one of those things, we'll regroup and we'll come back next year? Or is there an analysis that you can do to avoid that happening again in the future?
Well, I've obviously analysed it myself, and I kind of found it difficult to pinpoint where we went wrong. We did go wrong somewhere, and it's something that we do need to look at as a group. I'm sure that Paddy and Niall and all the lads that were involved last year have looked at it in depth to see where they went wrong, see where we all went wrong. And it's just something we're going to have to try build on, try regroup and get over it. It was hugely disappointing. It was my first year involved that we haven't been in an All-Ireland final. So it was a bit of a strange one. And for a lot of our management panel, it would have been their first ever championship loss. Now we've obviously lost games along the way, but we've never, like, since I'm involved, we've never lost the semi-final, and it's a strange one to take. I didn't really know how to feel afterwards, to be honest. But yeah.
Is it a situation now where you learn a lot more from this year than perhaps you learned from the previous couple of years, or did you actually? Because I remember you were in with us at the start of the year, and I think you'd said that a lot of efforts had gone in place to actually constantly evolve or constantly think about new ways to win, and that was always going to be the aim at the start of the three in a row quest.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you always need to improve year on year, and this year I suppose we just didn't do enough. Now, as I say, I can't pinpoint a specific point in the season where we went wrong or something that specifically was wrong with us on that day, which is obviously the management that was involved will have to look at that and see where we all went wrong. But it is a very difficult one to take. To be honest, we were awful on the day. Galway were much better than us.
Is it a weird feeling being somebody who can hold their head up high from an individual performance perspective? Like, granted, I'm basing that on the All-Stars, like being the only Cork person to get into the team, I think, in the end. Like, is that any consolation whatsoever a couple of months down the line? I presume it's not, but from a personal level in terms of giving you that confidence going into next year?
Well, personally, it obviously is a great achievement, and I was thrilled with the award, but like at the start of the year, you don't set out to win an All-Star, you don't set out to win Player of the Years, you don't. You set out at the start of the year with your 30-odd panel members, the however many in the management set up, to win an All-Ireland, and a year is not successful unless you win an All-Ireland at the end of the day, especially in Cork. Like, we're very, like, basically winning, not winning is not good enough. So overall, it was a very disappointing year. Obviously, the All-Star was, it was massive for me, it was massive for my club, but I can't say that it made up for anything. Like, it didn't. It still hurts, obviously, that we lost to Galway. But I suppose going into this year now, it'll be the first year that, I know we lost to Kilkenny a few years ago, But it'll be the first year that we don't have the target on our backs. You know, we're not the team to beat anymore. Mm. It's Kilkenny, it's Galway, probably more so Galway and maybe Kilkenny as well, because they've lost so many finals that they're now the teams to beat. They're the teams that everyone want to beat. All the kind of the other teams involved will want to beat them. So, yeah, maybe there's not a target on our back anymore. We're not the team to beat.
You said there that the All-Star was massive for your club. St. Vincent's Knocknaheeny, the first person to win an All-Star from the club. What was that reaction like? What were the people back home saying after you picked up the award?
So I won the award on, say, the Saturday night. Rang our club chairperson to tell him, but he obviously already knew from Twitter. And then the following day, I was bringing the award to the club to show the chairperson and to show a couple of girls on, say, my own team, my own junior team, my friends, like. And when I arrived at the club, there was basically hundreds of people there gathered to welcome me home. There was a guard of honour, there was a DJ. It was just, like, it was unbelievable what the club done for me, and it just showed what it meant to the club and to all the people where I live. So it was a huge honour for me to bring that back to the club and to see all the small kids kind of in awe that someone in their club won an All-Star. I know, say, like, the likes of Gemma O'Connor, who has so many All-Stars, her club probably take it for granted at this stage, but
sure,
they're, like, to my club, it's not something to take for granted. It's a huge honour for me to bring it back, and the club were delighted with that.
Can you talk to us about just how important a role St. Vincent's plays in a place like Knocknaheeny?
Yeah, like, obviously we have a huge kind of stigma around our area that there's big problems with drugs, alcohol, antisocial behaviour, and our club does so much in our area to try keep people involved in something. And it doesn't mean that they have to play. They can be involved in a team, like as a manager, as a coach a few kids in the academy. It just keeps people involved and it keeps people interested, and it's so important in our area to try keep people off the streets, to try keep them involved, like keep them with their friends, keep them on the straight and narrow. And it's so important in our area to keep that going, and there's huge work being done in the club for that.
Was it a situation where you experienced it firsthand, where there was teammates of yours that were perhaps dropping off for various reasons as you were growing up?
Yeah, definitely. It drives me absolutely insane when I think of the girls that we've lost along the way, like gifted players, like gifted, that if they were probably in any other area, they would have went on to do massive things with Cork. And even young girls now in the area, they're 16, they're 17, and like they're not playing anymore because their friends aren't playing, their friends are out drinking, their friends are doing this, that and the other. And it drives me insane that it maybe if they were in another area, they wouldn't be kind of, I don't know, they wouldn't be shown that behaviour is normal, whereas in our area, maybe it is normalised a bit much. So yeah, it frustrates me, and I've seen so many players kind of lost along the way. But this year we got a couple back and it was good. Now there's loads of work to be done, but this year was definitely positive. Even though we lost in the semi-final, it was positive in that we really built a good team there. And I hope that these younger girls that have kind of gone by the wayside a bit, these very talented girls, will look at the club and look what's being built there and maybe be drawn back to it.
Do you appreciate your own role in that? That I know you've had plenty of people say to you, well, you should move on to a more recognised club, a senior club, somewhere that might give you a better opportunity. But by staying, you are the emblem of the people that can actually go on and achieve great things by staying in Knocknaheeny, staying playing for St. Vincent's. Like, do you appreciate that role now, or is it something that you try to not focus on?
Well, it's not something I really focus on because I play with Vincent's because I absolutely love the place. I always say it'll never mean as much to me to win, say, a senior county with a so-called bigger club than win something with my own club. Unfortunately, we haven't been very successful. We haven't won anything, really. But I hope that in years to come, we will build something that people will be winning. And it's not even all about winning. Like, it's about being part of something. But obviously, the younger children probably do look up to me a bit. Because when I was a child, I had to look outside of my club. I had to look at the likes of the Bears for Gemma O'Connor, Orla Cotter they'd be my two heroes growing up, and I had to look outside my club. But maybe now the girls and even the boys, because they, like the boys in our club, what I love the most about my club is that it doesn't matter that I'm a female, they treat me exactly the same as they would if I was a male inter-county player. And then it goes even further when I'm Amy O'Connor and I was lucky enough to win an All-Star last week, but I'm treated the same as a six-year-old child who's just joined. Yeah. And that's what I love about my club so much. And I'd never leave. Obviously, there was rumours a few years ago that I was going to go and I was going to sign here and sign there. But at the end of the day, it would never mean as much to me as if I won something with Vincent's.
And is there an overall reason why you say people might have slipped off, got involved in the wrong choices in their life perhaps, that they're coming back now? Is it... is there a specific thing that Vincent's are doing or any reason why they are coming back?
There's huge work being put into the club, and the more people come back, the more again will come back, because they'll follow, they'll see that something great is potentially happening in the club. And we're trying, even the Camogie side of it, there's huge work going in, that it's being taken so much more seriously than it has been in previous years. We had a couple of great coaches in this year and it was brilliant for the club. And when people see that high standard being put into the Camogie, then it'll only attract people to go there and to go back playing. And obviously there's so many people that I'd love to get back playing that don't yet have the interest. But as soon as you start kind of doing something good and maybe start winning things, people will want to come back, and that's what it's all about. We just want people to be involved in something.
And was it ever a gender-specific thing in terms of people falling by the wayside? Were the boys more likely to hang around in Knocknaheeny and play a bit of hurling, or what was the situation there?
No, equally, I'd say, if you looked at the figures, I'd say both girls and boys were falling by the wayside. They were dropping out probably around 14, 15, 16 is kind of the age group. We don't have a 16 Camogie team or a minor Camogie team. We had to amalgamate with another club for a minor team to kind of facilitate other girls. So I couldn't say that it's more boys or more girls, but around that age group, it's very difficult to keep people involved, and you can see that when we don't have the 16s team. Now, our boys under 16s team this year have done very well because the coaches that were involved in them really put in time with them, and they actually went on and won. They won the football and they won the hurling in their division. So, that's a positive that we now have a winning under 16 team, whereas in previous years, maybe we wouldn't have had that because people would have... they would have dropped out and they would have left and they would have done this and that. So that's definitely a positive.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I clearly realise the role you have to play for boys as well as girls. It's everything. It's seeing a successful sports person in their locality. And I guess there's so many other clubs like that all around Ireland. It's not just in areas of Cork. We did a piece last year with Kevin's club in inner city Dublin, and the role that they have to play in an area of Dublin, that can be quite challenging at times, and just trying to get green spaces and things like that. You clearly are somebody who can speak firsthand about the role that the GEA can actually play in helping people like that and helping them along the right path.
Yeah, I always say there's something very special about the GEA. I know people outside of the GEA probably criticise the organisation a bit, but there's something very special about the GEA. And I, from my own experience playing soccer, say there is just that specialness about the GEA, and it's like a community. It's, you're all in it together. Do you know that kind of way?
Yeah.
And I think that's something that the GAA has over other sports. It's a real community thing. It's a real parish thing. And I think that's very special.
A final point. Where's Camogie at the moment, in your view, as a game, as a spectacle, in terms of how it's refereed, in terms of an attractive spectacle?
I thought the All-Ireland final was a great watch. As hard as it was for me to watch it, I thought it was a good watch. I do think it can improve again. We want to, at the end of the day, we want people to go to games and excite them. We want to show the skills of the game. And I think it will improve. There's a lot of work on in this year, since the start of the year, since all of the kind of players speaking out about the rule changes. There's a committee now set up to look at the rule changes. I think it may have sounded very negative at the start of the year, but we just kind of want to bring it to the next level. We want to bring it to the sport we know it can be, the skill, the speed. We want to excite people, the hurlers excite people, and I do think that we can do that. So I think there's a bit of work being done lately, and they're going to implement some changes in the rules. I know at the start of the year people were saying, oh, the women are calling for shouldering to be introduced to the game. That wasn't the goal at all. The goal was to kind of have a more free-flowing game and cut out the freeze a bit, because it was becoming a game of free takers. I think with a bit more work, then we can go forward with it, and we can make it the sport that we all know it can be. And at the end of the day, that's why we're speaking out about it, because we want just as much as the association, just as much as the referees and just as much as the rest of the counties. Like, we want it to go where we know it can go. I'm a firm believer that, like, Camogie can take off, and it's at a stage now where it could really blow up and, like, be massive.
What needs to happen for that to happen? Like, it's probably down to parents taking their kids to more games and things like that. Is that probably the first step?
So, yeah, I definitely think that, like, I always say it drives me insane when you go to a Cork senior men's game and you're down in Páirc Uí Chaoimh and there's hundreds of little girls there. I think, like, I'd challenge, say, men with daughters and even sons as well to bring their children to a Camogie game, because at the end of the day, their daughter is not going to be playing hurling. She's going to be playing Camogie. And if you make this step right now to get Camogie to increase the attendances, then when by the time your daughter plays, Camogie could be huge. Camogie could be just as big as hurling, and it won't be a matter of, like, women's sport. It'll just be sport. Mm. So, like, that would be my idea. I'd challenge mothers, fathers, bring your daughter to a Camogie match instead of a hurling match, because they can go to both, they can watch both. But, like, even with the Camogie games, they're much cheaper than the men's games.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you're investing in your daughter's future by doing that, because if you keep bringing your daughter to games, more people are going to games, and by the time she gets to play, you might be filling out Croke Park. Like, that, I hope that one day, I'd love to say that it will be in my playing career, that we will sell out Croke Park, and it will be just as exciting as hurling. It may never be as physical as hurling, just based on physiology and things like that. But that would be my thing. If you have a daughter, bring her to a Camogie game.
Yeah, it's a good message. And I guess that kind of comes back around to what we were saying about Knocknaheeny as well, in terms of people actually just viewing you as a sports person in the community. Yeah. That's done great things, and hopefully we'll get to that point in Camogie. Amy, very best of luck with the next couple of months. I presume you're going to go back to training pretty soon, or are you taking a bit of time off?
No, I'd say we should go back fairly soon. We've been out now since the 19th of August, I think, or the 18th of August, which is kind of a long layoff. We wouldn't be really... The winter was very long already.
Sure.
So hopefully we'll be back soon enough.
Well, best of luck with all of that. Great chatting to you, Amy O'Connor.
Million.
Thanks a million.
Thanks. OTB
AM. Okay, 12 minutes past nine this morning. Very welcome back to OTB AM, the sports breakfast show from Off the Ball. New Zealand Herald journalist Gregor Paul is joining us now from Japan to talk about the fallout from the All Blacks Rugby World Cup semi-final defeat to England. Gregor, you weren't as bullish about New Zealand's chances, in fairness, when we talked to you last week. I kind of thought that you were going to predict a confident victory for New Zealand. So there was obviously some doubts in your head ahead of the England game that did come home to roost. What was the root cause of your fears ahead of that match?
Oh, look, England are a good team. And I think they've been a good team for quite a wee while. You know, the way they played against Ireland, and I think it was in Dublin this year, hugely impressive. Thought they dispatched Australia quite impressively as well. And they were well matched to the All Blacks across the field. Eddie Jones, smart operator, he'd always talked that he felt he knew that England were going to end up playing the All Blacks in the semi-final, and he sort of gave the impression he'd been planning for it for a wee while. And look, it was a World Cup semi-final. There was a wee bit of a feeling too that the All Blacks had maybe invested an awful lot to get past Ireland. You know, they really put in a huge performance emotionally, physically, mentally. They put it all in there, and just had a wee feeling that the edge would be with England in that game. I didn't think it would be quite as obvious as it was, but I always had a sense that England were going to get up for that one.
I wondered if 18 months out, New Zealand felt that maybe Ireland were the team that they would end up playing in a final, and that's why there was so much emotional energy invested in the game, because it doesn't make sense to invest so much energy if you're New Zealand in a quarterfinals otherwise.
I wouldn't agree with the first part, but I think the second part, look, you've got to invest a huge amount into the quarterfinal, otherwise you're not getting into the semi-final. And New Zealand have made that mistake before, 2007, where they didn't, you know, they were already worrying about, you know, who they were going to pick in the semi-final, because they had one or two guys coming back from injury. And the one thing that they have learned about World Cups is that you don't look beyond the quarterfinal. So they knew that Ireland were going to be a huge challenge, and they knew that they were going to have to play and put everything into the quarterfinal. And then they struggled last time they won the World Cup too, in 2015, where they did the same thing, huge performance against France, and then they struggled to back it up against South Africa, but they got home on that occasion.
Mm.
And so there was also a wee bit of a feeling that they might You know, it's hard to invest in the quarterfinal and then back it up in the semi-final. And, you know, I mean, I think I'm talking to Ireland here who never got out of the quarterfinal. You know, and that's important to understand that you've got to throw everything in there to get out the other side of it. And that's why winning the World Cup is so hard, because you do it once and then you got to front again and do it twice. And as England and South Africa are going to have to do, one of them's going to have to do it three times to win the World Cup.
So maybe the quarterfinal was too soft for New Zealand, is what you're saying.
look, that was a great game for New Zealand to get involved in. It put them straight into finals mode. But look, they looked a wee bit flat, I thought, in the semi-final. They looked a wee bit shell-shocked. There's a lot of things that they looked. But, you know, the way that England played, you can't take that away. You can't remove that from being a huge factor. That a lot of the it was a bit like what the All Blacks did to Ireland the week before. You know, New Zealand made Ireland look a lot more ordinary than they really were. New Zealand put Ireland under so much pressure that, you know, Ireland were forced into making mistakes. It looked like the Irish were flat, that they hadn't brought much to the game. And then England turned around and did pretty much the same thing to the All Blacks. They made them look a worse team than they really are, because they were able to get pressure across the field, and they put scoreboard pressure on them. And as everybody knows, when you're chasing a game, that's when compound errors can come, when decision-making can be compromised because you're trying to push things. And that's what England did. It looked awfully like what New Zealand did to Ireland the week before.
Did they get the team selection wrong? The back row in particular, Steve Hansen's come in for a bit of criticism around that.
Yeah, look, Steve Hansen sort of put his hand up and said, look, I'll take the blame for that. It was a wee bit of a surprise. We didn't see it coming. And, you know, the way the game turned out, you'd say it wasn't the right call. But I think they were a wee bit disappointed. I don't know if the selection was as bad as all that, or as, you know, if it was a crazy thing to do. What happened in the end was they really threw their chips into the line out, didn't they? That's where they thought they were going to be able to target England, put them under pressure on the touchline. And we saw an inordinate amount of line outs for an All Blacks test. I don't know how many there were, but there were more than usual. And they, you know, England won their own ball every single time. So the All Blacks' plan backfired. They thought they were going to put them under pressure, steal a few. And to make it worse, the All Blacks couldn't find their own targets, and they lost four in a row. So, I mean, is that a selection thing or is that an execution thing out on the field? Because, you know, they really didn't perform at that level and do what they were supposed to do. So it made it look like it was a poor decision to play Barrett, because that's what he was in the team to do, win the line-out ball.
Will there be a significant amount of bloodletting in New Zealand after this, or because it was the end of the Hansen era, is there a nice, neat little bow on it and there's no real point in criticising the team management, there's no real point in criticising the players, because no one knows exactly what the selection will be next year when they get back into whatever mode of competition they're in?
Yeah, look, to some extent it's kind of a natural cycle, isn't it? And the coach is moving on, the captain's moving on. There's a handful of senior players who are all moving on. So, there's no point in having a massive inquiry into this. And look, secondly, I think everyone can see that sometimes in sport you just have to accept that the other lot, however hard it is, and particularly when it's England, I guess, for New Zealanders, they outplayed them. You know, they brought more to the game. They had a desperation and urgency that New Zealand didn't have. They didn't. I mean, look, England played brilliantly, and they may struggle to play that well again for some time, because they barely missed a tackle. You know, everything they did was just about perfect, and that's going to be very hard to replicate. And I think people in New Zealand can actually, I think they've grown up a wee bit because the All Blacks have won the last two World Cups. I think people can accept that they're not going to win every World Cup, and we don't need to, you know, fire the coach and, you know, woe betide what's coming next. You know, everything's horrible. The All Blacks' era of dominance is over. We don't really need to go down that road, because I think England just played particularly well, and there's a level of maturity now in the country that can accept that.
Which comes from having won two World Cups. I guess if they hadn't won those two World Cups, then this would be national crisis time again.
Oh, my goodness. If they hadn't won two World Cups, we'd be setting fire to things right now, and Steve Hansen's house would have people with pitchforks outside. It would be crazy. But now, look, winning World Cups alleviates a lot, as does, you know, the performance of the team really for the last 10 years probably has been fairly outstanding. You know, they've only lost, 10 tests in the last, I don't know what the period is, 4 or 5 years. So, look, it's a phenomenal record. And I think people have also realised that you can't throw everything onto a World Cup and say, well, you didn't win it, so it's terrible, the world's going to end. I think there's also a sort of level of perspective now that says, like, it's pretty difficult to win Test matches, to win the Rugby Championship, to win the Bledisloe Cup consistently the way that they have. So the record's been phenomenal. It is disappointing for people, you know, that it ended the way it did, particularly as it felt like New Zealand didn't perform the way that they wanted. And that has left an element of disappointment for the players, for the coaches, for people back home. But, you know, I think everyone will get over this one a bit quicker than they have in the past.
It sounds like you subscribe to Warren Gatland's theory that perhaps you can play your final in a semi-final. Would you go along with that perhaps England have played their biggest game of the tournament?
Well, I mean, obviously we're going to find out, aren't we? I think you'd have to believe that they're going to struggle to get up to that level of intensity again. Look, it was a performance that reminded me a lot of the way that Ireland played in November against the All Blacks, when they were just about perfect as well that day, where they got themselves up and they played exactly how they wanted to play, and they played like that for 80 minutes and everything went their way. And England were like that. And I mean, I'm not taking anything away from them, but I've never seen a game where every single loose ball ended up falling into an English hand. And it was kind of incredible how the game went so far in their direction. But they earned a lot of that. You know, they earned it with the way that they played. I think they're going to find it quite difficult to replicate that perfect performance against South Africa, just because it's very difficult to do that 2 weeks in a row. And in which case, I think they're going to be a wee bit nervous as well, because I think they realise that they now owe themselves a second performance, having done what everybody would say was the hardest thing, beat the All Blacks, and now they're in a final, and they're favourites to win the final. I think they might be a wee bit nervous, and I think they're going to struggle a little bit, more than they perhaps realise. And, you know, South Africa have come through a different route, and we'll see.
Just a final one for me anyway, Gregor. Was that the original Ghostbusters or the new Ghostbusters on the TV behind you there?
I think it's on the phone here. They seem to love playing music at you. So I don't know whether you can hear it or not. It's driving me nuts.
It was a bit of Thriller, a bit of Ghostbusters, and some talking in Japanese. So we figured it was a proper World Cup experience. Listen, enjoy. Look, the third, fourth place playoff in a Rugby World Cup is one of the most bizarre occasions that you can ever be at. I was at the one in London 4 years ago, and like, it just didn't make any sense. It just doesn't make any sense for, particularly for a collision sport like rugby, to have this game. How are New Zealand and the New Zealand camp and the New Zealand rugby public dealing with the fact that they have to play this game?
Well, I don't know about the public, but for the All Blacks, they've had to kind of suck it up and get over it quite quickly, because, you know, as they've been saying all tournament, it doesn't really make any difference whether you're playing a semi-final or you're playing Namibia in a pool game, Ireland in November, or indeed a third, fourth place playoff. The expectation in New Zealand is that none of that matters. The All Blacks is a test match, and the All Blacks have got to win it. So that they've had to get their head around that pretty quickly and get over sulking or not wanting to be there. They're going to have to be there. And look, a bad situation of being knocked out of a World Cup will become a very bad situation if they lose to Wales for the first time in goodness knows how long. And you've also got a number of, you know, you've got Kieran Reid, Sonny Bill Williams, Ben Smith, Ryan Crotty, and of course Steve Hansen. This is all their last test match with the All Blacks. So
yeah,
that in itself is the reason why they're going to get reasonably pumped up and fired. Ben Smith would be another one. You know, so there's all that on the line. And look, people have reacted moderately well to them losing. But if they lose to Wales, I think things might turn a wee bit nasty and a wee bit feral. So I think they'll be pretty keen to finish off no matter the occasion. They're wearing a black jersey. I think they'll be quite keen to play well. And,
all right,
you know, Brian get a little bit of solace out of the tournament.
Gregor, good stuff. Great to have you with us. Thanks a million. Enjoy the game. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Gregor Paul there, the New Zealand Herald columnist. Jockey Paddy Merrigan was in studio last night opening up about his experiences of depression and substance abuse in the TG Carr documentary series Finne. He joined us in studio and tackled a lot of heavy topics. It's a piece well worth revisiting on YouTube or on offtheball.com or indeed on the Go Loud app as well. Here's a taste of the conversation.
I knew instant that it was just, I loved it. I had a passion for it. Not only that, I was good at it instantly. I was jumping horses within a few days. And what had happened was I just became addicted to the place. So pretty much what had happened, I wouldn't go to school. I was ditching school and going riding horses. But I always felt like I was doing the right thing.
Yeah, because that once you almost feel like it's a vocation from the off. And you can explain that way in your head and just go, but this is what I'm going to do. Why do I need to sit in the classroom and be told, you know, formulae for maths and all that kind of thing, when all I need to do is know how to ride a horse properly?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know what it is now, but like when I was in school, it was all old-fashioned teachers that were just, this is how you have to do it.
Yeah.
And that's it. And it just wasn't right for me, you know. Now, I do see maybe today, I'm sure today school has changed a lot as well, like the world in general. But yeah, it's definitely something, it just wasn't for me. School wasn't for me.
What did your folks make of it when you were...
My mum actually didn't know for months. It's quite funny because she used to, like, think I was in school all the time. But what I used to do was just ditch school and go riding the horses. But then the school had writ to my mother and said, where's your son been? And my mother was like, what the, you know? So she contacted me and said, have you not been in school? And I said, no, I haven't been in for months. And so what she had to do then, she used to drop me down to the front door of the school.
Yeah.
And once she dropped me, and she'd watch me walk in. But all I do is walk straight by her, walk by all the teachers, and I would go out and jump the back wall and I'd be gone. And that was it. I remember that as clear as day.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story. Loads of great stuff in that interview. The best place to get it is the Go Loud app, or indeed on offtheball.com. Phil is here. Phil, good morning to you.
Morning, lads. How are you doing?
What's going on?
The English League Cup. It's going to... We'll get the quarterfinals finalised tonight, but there's a couple of decent games to look forward to tonight, and you've got a choice. What do you do? Do you watch Liverpool Arsenal 7:30, or maybe watch the start of it, and then at 8:05, are you tempted to flick over then to Chelsea Man U?
No. What? Never not watch Arsenal play, really, is the answer here. It's always, it's fireworks will always happen, especially against a team that might tear them asunder.
It's going to be more crack, isn't it? Liverpool Arsenal going to be more crack.
Liverpool's B team won't tear Arsenal asunder.
Very, very big compliments to Arsenal there. Who knows? It could be another 9-0, Phil.
No, I don't think so.
Either way, you don't not watch Arsenal, especially when they're up against another top six team, because anything could happen.
Yeah, well, I think you certainly start watching it. Maybe watch the first half, and then you've got the 15 minutes where you can take in a bit of Chelsea and Man U, and you've also got the end of the Chelsea United game to look at as well. It's
one television is clearly your problem there, Phil.
I think you've got to stick with the one game, because if you start going with two screens, you're kind of trying to look between the two of them, you're missing what's going on, no?
It's old school, like Andy Merrigan's teachers. No, you've got to have two screens, because life comes at you too quick, too boring.
No, I've no problem with the two screens, but put most of the focus in one. And then...
A secondary relationship.
But yeah. that could
a
be a way
bit on the side, Phil, literally.
Yeah, well, like what I tend to do is I'd have an iPad, so I'd have a headphone in. So if there's something happening in the second game on the iPad, I'll hear it.
And it's like a call center.
Over. I can look over. Yeah,
it's an interesting setup. I suppose if you had Liverpool Arsenal as your bit on the side, you might make a bit more
that'd
noise.
That'd be my main course.
First love.
Yeah.
You're married to Liverpool, basically.
Are you married to Liverpool? Congratulations.
Certainly not, but Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea, Manchester United, and then the other one, let's not forget about Aston Villa and Wolves.
Yeah, Wolves B team of 216 million strikers.
And a bit
on the side to the bit on the side.
Yeah, so I think regardless of what happens tonight, you're guaranteed to have a pretty good quarterfinal lineup, obviously, after what happened last night. Now, Oxford and Colchester are in that draw, which is going to take place tomorrow. So, you know, Man City are probably going to draw Oxford or Colchester. But City are the masters of the League Cup. They're on course for three in a row. They won 3-1 at home to Southampton last night. And they actually play the Saints at the Etihad again on Saturday afternoon as well. Sergio Aguero scored two. Nicolas Otamendi scored as well. You kind of feared for Southampton 2-0 at half time. You thought this could be another hiding. I think they'd be quite happy. To use a Mick McCarthy stock phrase, you know, if you'd offered them 3-1 at half time, they'd have taken it.
Can you not do Mick McCarthy's accent?
No, I can't. You've got an excellent Mick McCarthy.
I don't have to do it.
You've got an excellent Mick McCarthy. I don't know why you hide this light under a bushel, Phil.
What?
This is like
Because like I didn't really understand the quote there without Mick McCarthy's accent.
Nah, nah, we'll, maybe we'll wait till Mick is out of the job.
Well, I mean,
I don't think it's right to be
a couple of weeks to be to be doing his voice. Well, you mean you walk around doing his voice all the time?
Yeah, but I'm just holding it in, like, you know. Yeah,
peddlers of doom.
Peddlers of doom. Anyway, speaking of Mick McCarthy and his captain, Seamus Coleman, he was back in the Everton team for their 2-0 win against Watford. Leicester also in. They won 3-1 away to Burton. I mentioned Oxford and Colchester winning as well. So that draw for the quarterfinals is tomorrow. Celtic and Rangers both in Scottish Premiership action tonight. They're level on points. Celtic are 3 goals better off. Champion Celtic are at home to St Mirren. Rangers travel to Ross County. Joey Carberry is set to miss Munster's opening 2 Champions Cup games against the Ospreys and Racing 92. He has an ankle injury which he picked up in August. This is the same injury that troubled him during the World Cup as well. England have been fined a 4-figure sum. They're talking about £2,000 is the figure going around. This is for crossing the halfway line as they faced New Zealand's Haka before last weekend's semi-final. I'm pretty sure they'd be happy to pay that fine. But the reason they have to pay it is World Rugby stipulates that teams must remain within their own half of the pitch while the Haka goes on. Steve Hansen has made 7 changes for that bronze medal match that you were talking about just a few minutes ago against Wales on Friday. So we've got Dane Coles, Sonny Bill Williams, Kieran Reid will captain the team. That's his final international appearance. Warren Gatland's made 9 changes for his final game in charge of Wales. Owen Lane is going to make his debut. He was brought over after Josh Navidi was ruled out of the tournament. Nicky Smith, James Davis also in as well. No George North, no Lee Halfpenny. Might be third time lucky tonight in Donegal. Reigning champions Gweedore take on Naomh Connell in Ballybuffet. That's at 8 o'clock, the second replay of the Donegal club football final. Wow. And finally, Aoife Fitzgerald has been ratified as the manager of the Cork ladies senior footballers. Given a 2-year term, remember he was in charge for 4 years, set after the All-Ireland semi-final defeat to Dublin. Yeah, that's enough. Me done. Yeah. But U-turn, and he's back in now for another 2-year term.
There's no penalties after the Gweedore game tonight, is there?
Presume there will be.
This is the one with, there should be. We don't know.
Like, but
somebody might intervene or not.
Most counties have tended to do so. Yeah.
Yeah. Ulster game this weekend.
Yeah.
Ah, Jesus.
They should have just got it out. Well, you see, the thing was,
it was Castlerann, isn't it?
Yeah, Castlerann.
Might have run out of daylight last weekend. Is the issue? Yeah, that certainly was one of the reasons.
Yet they're playing midweek under floodlights.
Yeah, is it in the same ground? I just know that it was an issue in Kerry at the weekend with darkness.
Okay. There'll always be an issue with darkness in Kerry. That's it from us this morning here on OTB AM.
Thanks. Please do the McCarthy voice before you go.
Come on, yeah. No. Stay tuned to do the last bit here. Stay tuned to the upper tunnels. Come on.
You can't have Richard Cooper coming in here doing this stuff.
He doesn't do Mick McCarthy.
He can do a good Mick McCarthy.
Well, he hasn't done it recently.
He used to do it on Apri Match.
Hasn't done it in here.
It's not the time already.
Come on.
Starving I am.
If you missed anything from OTBM this morning, Gregor Paul, Amy O'Connor, Stephen Kelly, the sports pages, you can catch the podcast back on offtheball.com/podcast or the Go Loud app. Watch it back on our YouTube channel and subscribe. Off the Ball live tonight from 7 o'clock until 10. We'll see you tomorrow. Good luck.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.